Hello, I'm Bill Bryson, and I'm speaking to you in English. And so are all these people.
Fela itchon tham bercha, ye beeden haba, rathra wurda. Ye seak itch weirda god.
Only were a never a non mathiers, swa peened as
the drucht of math chath persed to the rota, and bathed every
to take arms against the say of troubles. And by opposing and
I was born in Nottinghamshire, more to the northern part, but there when I was about 8 or 9 years
like
old.
Like in Tumas, long kaikai dispala tripala liklik pick. All time, and
I discovered that to most of them, Persia was little more than a vague romantic name. They had very little idea of where it exactly was.
Hurls all sorts of abuse at me, and all through question time, these two pansies over there, what with retractions of the things.
But this isn't English. This is the choir of St. Peter's Church on South Uist in the Outer Hebrides. The words are Gaelic, one of the Celtic languages which once dominated much of Western Europe, but now exist only in pockets like this, mostly on its loneliest fringes. We tend to think of English as a timeless and inevitable component of life in Britain. In fact, it is neither. As languages go, it is a relative stripling, and its very existence somewhat improbable. Had history taken any of several very slight turns, we might all now be speaking a language very like the Gaelic of South Uist, or perhaps like modern Dutch, or Danish, or French. Few of the world's languages have had to weather greater knocks and buffetings in the course of their history, or been more gloriously enriched in the process. If there is one sterling quality about English, it is not the orderliness of its grammar or the richness of its vocabulary. It is simply its remarkable ability to survive. The beginnings of most languages are lost in the mists of prehistory, but for English we have a pretty good idea. The story starts in about the year 450 AD, when bands of Germanic peoples, Angles, Saxons, Jutes, and probably Frisians, crossed the North Sea to southeast England and, in a piecemeal fashion, began taking the land away from the native Celts. It's difficult to conceive the sense of indignity that the Celts must have felt at finding themselves overrun by primitive, unlettered warriors from the barbaric fringes of the Roman Empire. For the Celts were a sophisticated people. For nearly four centuries they had been part of a great civilization and enjoyed the privileges and comforts that went with it. But now, with the Roman Empire crumbling and the legions called home, they were hopelessly vulnerable. The native Celts referred to the invaders as Saxons, and the land under their sway was first known as Saxonia. But at some point in the first 100 years or so, for reasons unknown, the invaders became generally referred to as Angli, and the land they conquered as Anglia, even though the Angles were only a small and possibly incidental part of the invading forces. They settled in places like this, at Sutton Hoo in Suffolk. In 1938, an amateur archaeologist named Basil Brown, investigating some interesting mounds in this field through which I'm now walking, made one of those discoveries archaeologists dream of. He'd found an ancient Anglo-Saxon burial site, containing an 89-foot-long ship buried in this mound here to my left, and an incomparably rich collection of jewelry, regalia, and other artifacts. But there was nothing here, and precious little elsewhere, to indicate how these people spoke and what they sounded like. To find out how much we know about the language of these people, I went to Cambridge to see Ray Page, a tall, bearded emeritus professor of Anglo-Saxon studies at Corpus Christi. Is it possible to say when English began?
No, I don't think it's possible to say that. What we can say is that there are some very early objects that have what are clearly words or names written on them. But we don't know exactly what they mean, or what the words, if they are words, mean, or what the names imply. There's one on a brooch from Wakerley in Northamptonshire, which simply says, Boo-hoo, B-U-H-U. Now, goodness knows what boo-hoo means.
So I'm just trying to get some idea of the of how much you have to work with, or how little you have to work with. How many different pieces of information might be out there?
Oh, you're in the tens and at the most hundreds.
Really?
Yes, oh yes. And this is always a problem. What do you expect to find inscribed on an object? If you were to go into some houses, you see a doormat and it has a text written on it. Then you go into the bathroom and see the bath mat, and that has a text written on it. Now, the one in the bathroom says bath mat. So you go to the doormat, and you say, oh, that must say doormat, but what it says is welcome. Now, how could you have guessed that?
Yes.
If those were the only two bits of the English language you had surviving from that century, how would you know what the relationship between those two statements were?
And is that approximately the sort of situation dealing with?
We have quite a lot of inscriptions in Scandinavia, but a lot of them say absolutely nothing. You see, there's beautiful runic inscription on a piece of bone, and it says "Theta er bein." This is bone. Well, great news! <you know>? Hurrah! We all shout. We've got a text here, but it's not telling you much about the nature of life.
For the first piece of real evidence of an emergent English language, we must travel 280 miles north from Cambridge to Dumfries and Galloway. There, in the village church of Rothwell, I met English language professor Richard Hogg, who travelled up specially from Manchester University. So tell me, Richard, why have you brought me to this obscure corner of southwest Scotland?
Well, it certainly is obscure, and this is a tiny little church, but once we go in, what we are going to see is a cross, an Anglo-Saxon cross, that was made round about 700, or just shortly afterwards. And that cross is decorated with panels. It has Latin inscriptions on it, but that's not what we are here to see. Although, I'm no doubt that will be interesting. What we will see is an extract from an Anglo-Saxon poem called The Dream of the Rood. And this extract, which we find here, is possibly the very first piece of English literature that we have.
Really?
Really, indeed. There is stuff that is written maybe a couple of decades later, which is certainly literature, but before that we only have one or two word inscriptions and the occasional charter with English names in it. But this is a piece of real Old English poetry.
Well, great, let's go have a look.
Now, I'm in the same position as you. I've not seen this cross for real before either, so I'm just as excited as you are about seeing it. Gosh.
Wow, it's really something.
It's very, very impressive.
I mean, the most striking thing to me is that it's much bigger than I'd expected.
Yes, it's about 18 foot tall. And what you see, apart from a wonderful sculpture, is down at the top of the sculpture and down the sides of the sculpture, what you see at first sight is what looked like a lot of Roman numerals. But they're not Roman numerals. They're runic letters. They're letters from the runic alphabet, which the Anglo-Saxons brought with them across from the continent.
Now, can you decipher any of this?
I can read it to you.
Please.
In Anglo-Saxon. Just the short passage that leads up to Christ was on the cross. Fela itchontham bercha yabiden haba rathra wurda. Yeseach ich werda God therla thenian, thustro havdan berigen mid walken welden des hrau, shirna shiman, shedu forth eda, wan unda walknum, weop el yeshaft, quid on kuningus fool, Christ was on roda. I have endured terrible fates on that hill. I saw the Lord of hosts suffer terribly. Darkness had covered in clouds the body of the Lord. A shadow shone across the earth. It grew dark underneath the clouds. All creation wept for the fall of the king. Christ was on the cross.
Old English was an immensely complex tongue, full of abstruse declensions and complex inflections. Yet it was also a language of great resourcefulness and vitality, a language rich in possibility, as the linguistic historian Otto Jespersen has put it. And once its users became literate, as they did in the 6th century with the introduction of Christianity by St. Augustine, their language and literature flowered with astonishing speed and assurance. This cultural outpouring found its sharpest focus in the far northern kingdom of Northumbria. Here, on the outermost edge of the civilized world, sprang forth England's first great poet, Cædmon, its first great historian, the Venerable Bede, and its first great scholar, Alcuin of York, who became head of Charlemagne's palace school at Aachen and was one of the progenitors of the Renaissance. For a time, as the historian Simeon Potter has put it, the light of learning shone more brightly in Northumbria than anywhere else in Europe. Barely had this cultural revival got underway than England and her young language were under attack again, this time by Viking invaders. These were people who were related to the Anglo-Saxons by both language and blood. At first, the Viking incursions consisted of hit-and-run raids along the east coast, but by the 9th century they came in ever greater numbers with the intention of conquest and settlement. After a series of battles, in 878 a treaty was signed between the English king Alfred and the Norse intruders, establishing what was called the Danelaw, a line dividing control of Britain between the English in the south and the Norse-speaking Danes in the north. The Danish influence on the English language was considerable. The scale of their settlements can be seen from the fact that more than 1,400 place names in northern England are of Scandinavian origin. One of the most important centers of power and commerce was York, or Jorvik, as it was known to the Norsemen.
I'd just like to come here and just tell you a little bit about the museum. Now then, it's based on an archaeological dig that was done on this site, done by York Archaeological Trust.
At the popular Jorvik Centre in York, they've taken great pains to capture the sounds of the Norse language spoken in the 10th century.
First of all, though, you get in a little electric car, takes you backwards in time, back to the year 948. That's your destination this morning. And when you get there, the time car turns round and you see all the sights, sounds and smell the smells of one street of the busy town of Jorvik.
But how can we possibly know, nearly 1,000 years after the fact, what these people sounded like? Ray Page was one of the linguists who worked on the recreation of Viking voices.
Yes, well, one of the bits we had in the soundtrack from the Jorvik Centre, it's spoken by an old man called Gamal, which means old, and what he says is, Vesel mavar och elaskapi klerat hivetna. Hon theta sinis ekimikit honna kluck. Now, the first bit of that is a bit of genuine Old Norse. It's from an Old Norse poem that probably dates from the late Viking Age, but isn't recorded until the 13th century. It's a bit of verse, and what it means is, a poor sort of chap and one not very bright is tends to laugh at anything that's going on. Now, of the genuine Old Norse there, the stuff that comes from an early poem, we know that the words are all right for the 13th century. We believe that they were reasonably all right for, shall we say, the 11th or 10th centuries. But we know in general terms how they are pronounced from the spelling. And we assume that the spelling is a close indication of pronunciation. And that's the most we can do.
Now, what would English be like today if it hadn't been for the Norse invasion?
Oh, there would be a number of some very common words indeed in modern English which would be presumably different. One obvious example is the word they. Now, the Old English word for they was he, and that was, of course, easily confused with the singular he. The Old Norse word for they is their, and presumably at some time it was thought that it was advisable to have some distinction between he and they, and so the English brought in the Norwegian or Scandinavian form with a th sound at the front of it, and so that is now the common word in the English language. There are a number of other quite common words that occur in the English language which are of either Norwegian or Scandinavian origin, or alternatively have been influenced by Scandinavian sounds. For example, the word to get, which again is as common a word as you can get almost in the English language, would be jettan in Old English, but getta in Old Norse. Now, jettan should give the modern English word yet, but instead we have the Norsified form, get, presumably due to influence of pronunciation.
Altogether, the Scandinavians gave English some 2,000 words which still survive in the language, among them sky, skull, freckle, leg, scream, trust, and husband. Sometimes these new terms displaced Old English words, but often they took up residence alongside them, adding a useful synonym to the language, so that today in English we have both craft and skill, wish and want, shriek and screech, ditch and dyke, nay and no. But one final cataclysm awaited the English language in its formative period, the Norman conquest of 1066. The Normans were Vikings who had settled in northern France 200 years before, but had, rather strangely, given up their own language and culture and become thoroughly Frenchified. Their conquest of Britain was, it hardly needs saying, one of the great and decisive moments in the development of the English language. Derek Britton, from Edinburgh University, is an expert on the period. We met in a restaurant, for reasons that will become apparent in a moment, and I asked him how immediate and widespread an impact there was from the Norman conquest.
There was an immense influence through the existence of French as a prestige language in England from the time of the conquest to towards the end of the 15th century. But that influence was principally through the vast, vast amount of borrowing of words. French influence on the actual structure of English was minimal. In other words, the notion that the profound structural changes whereby English lost many of its inflections on nouns, adjectives and demonstratives was in any way influenced by French is simply not true, certainly not demonstrable. English would have evolved in terms of its grammar and its suffixation very much as it had if the Normans had been routed at the Battle of Hastings.
Excuse me, miss, could we have a menu, please? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Right, Bill, well, what we're going to do then is we're going to look for medieval French borrowings, many of which are actually going to look really rather homely and native, in fact.
So what do you see here that tells us something about the development of English?
All right, well, let's look at the starters, shall we, for instance. Now, you'll find that nearly all the fish terms are foreign and are medieval French loans. Mackerel, humble mackerel, but delicious, is from French.
And that will have driven out an Old English fish name?
Almost certainly, but I couldn't tell you what that was. Salmon, plaice.
Now what about the...
And soup, of course, we should not forget. Soup is a borrowing from French, granted with sort of later French influence on pronunciation. Otherwise, we would have been saying soup of the day instead of soup of the day.
Right. Now, what about the thing that you often see in books that the beasts of the field had Old English names, but once they were cut up and brought to table, they were given French names. Is that true?
That's right. And on the main courses, we can see the roast beef of Old England with Yorkshire pudding, for instance. Now, unfortunately, roast beef is entirely alien. Roast is itself a borrowing, as are many terms for types of preparation, if you like, but beef then, right, is actually a borrowing from French birth. And as you were saying, we have ox and cow, but beef, calf, but French veal, sheep, but French mutton, deer but French. Venison, pig but French. Pork.
The Norman conquest might have spelled the death knell for English. Instead, it strengthened it. Its lowly status almost certainly helped English to become a simpler, less inflected language, for which we can all be grateful. A little of the Old English complexity survives in a few common verbs, like to be, with its various forms of was, were, is, am, and are, and in a few irregular plurals like oxen, geese, and teeth. But for the most part, the grammar of English became comparatively regular and logical. Gender vanished too, mercifully, so we have none of the irksome uncertainty as in French of having to learn to write la plume or le plume, le parapluie or la parapluie. And it was vastly richer in vocabulary. From the Normans alone, English borrowed 10,000 words, 40% of them, ironically, in the last 150 years up to about 1400, when Norman influence was in its most rapid decline. Three-quarters of those words are still common in English usage.
One important point I wanted to make in terms of the history of French in England was that we know that by the 13th century, even the children of many of the great magnates of England were not acquiring French as their birth language, but were being instructed in it. And we know that because we have surviving manuals of instruction in French, you see. So it was being actually, from as early as the sort of beginning of the 13th century, one suspects, to be artificially maintained through instruction and study. So by the 13th century, it had actually become the birth language of very few people in the country.
So English triumphed in the end, though of course it was a very different language, in many ways a quite separate language from the Old English of Alfred the Great or Bede. In fact, Old English would have seemed about as incomprehensible to Geoffrey Chaucer as it does to us, so great had been the changes in the time of the Normans. Under the long onslaught of the Scandinavians and Normans, many thousands of Old English words died out, 85% of them altogether. Today, only about 4,500 words in English, about 1% of the total number of words in the language, are of Old English origin. But they include many of the most fundamental terms in the language: eat, drink, man, wife, child, house, heaven, and God, among others, as well as most of the basic function words of the language, words like a, an, the, to, for, and. As a result, in any list of the 100 most common words in English, 98 or even 99 will be of Old English origin. What emerged then was quite a mongrel language, but a particularly expressive one. Richard Hogg again.
One of the great things about English is it has taken words, vocabulary from a wide range of languages, most obviously Latin and French, and then Scandinavian, but it's taken words from almost every other language in the world. And when they have been taken in large numbers, as the French words have and the Latin words have, they usually haven't simply replaced English, native English words, they've been used alongside them, and then we exploit them. So that, for example, if you take three words, regal, royal, and kingly, which all, as it were, mean the same thing, belonging to a king, regal is a Latin word, royal is a French word, kingly is the native English word, and they have different connotations. Regal is, if you like, to use another word which means virtually the same thing, the most majestic of these. And kingly is the most down to earth. And royal is the middle class one, if you like.
To get some sense of just how mongrel a language English has become, I set Richard Hogg and Derek Britton a small task.
Well, I wonder if maybe we could just illustrate this by having a look at a copy of today's newspaper.
Here's a, there's a, an article here. Play the game, public schools tell their boys. Now, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 words. And of those, play, the, game, tell, and possibly boys are Old English in origin. How many is that? Has anybody been counting whilst I've been doing
five
this?
Out of eight.
Five out of eight. It's a very high proportion, actually. Of the others, you have public schools and there. Public and schools are both of Latin or French origin. Public, probably Latin through French. Schools, more closely allied to Latin. So you've got two words of Romance origin, at least. And then you have there, and that's of Scandinavian origin. And that's really quite unusual in languages of the world to borrow words like there.
It must mean that there was very close contact between English and Old Norse, that there must have been a period in some parts of the country of widespread bilingualism for a function word like that. In fact, we've borrowed the whole system of Old Norse pronouns so that they, their, and them are borrowed lock, stock and barrel. All the Old English third-person pronouns began with H, and all that we've got left are sort of her and he, no, and his and him.
This is actually... Here's an article called Plain English Flew Over Tale of Office Affair. An employee of the Plain English campaign resorted to plain speaking in the face of rumours that he was having an affair with a female colleague, an industrial tribunal was told yesterday.
English employee, medieval French borrowing, of English, the English, plain, borrowed from French. English.
So, in 700 years, English had developed from a purely Germanic tongue into an unusually rich and vibrant hybrid, with a versatility and vocabulary unlike any the world had seen before. It was ready to take its place on the world stage. But to deal with that, we need another program.
English, the English, face French, of English, rumours French, that English, he English, was English, having English, an English, affair, a very French affair, with English, a English.
Hello. This week we're going to look at how English went from this.
The drucht of math chaff per cent other order, and bathed every vine...
To this.
...or to take arms against the sea of troubles, and by opposing end them.
To this.
I was born in Nottinghamshire, more to the northern part, but there when I was about 8 or 9 years old did we go ourselves to Holland.
To this.
Hurls all sorts of abuse at me, and all through question time, these two pansies over there, what with retractions of the things which we said about...
But our story this week starts with this.
Tha, namen he tha men tha he weinden that any god hevden, ba the be nichtes and be dyers, carl men and women, and didden hem in prison.
An extract from the Peterborough Chronicle, written in about 1155, describing a period of anarchy some 18 years earlier, following the reign of King Stephen, and describing in graphic detail the oppression and torture of local people.
He did a hymn in Quarterne, the nadras and snackers and padders were in and drapping him swar.
Because of turmoil in the country, work on the Chronicle was suspended for 23 years, between 1131 and 1154, just at the period when English was undergoing some of its most dramatic changes. In the earlier section, the writing is Old English, an immensely complex tongue, full of abstruse declensions and complex inflections. A single word could take a multiplicity of forms depending on tense, mood, case, and other grammatical attributes. Even something as basic as the definite article the could be masculine, feminine, or neuter, and had five variant forms as a singular and four as a plural. But when the Chronicle resumes in 1154, the language used is immeasurably simpler. The period of Middle English had begun. For most of us, the period of Middle English is associated with Geoffrey Chaucer, though in fact Chaucer was writing some 200 years after the completion of the Peterborough Chronicle. Derek Britton from Edinburgh University has studied how the language of that time might have sounded.
The Chaucer I'm going to give you is going to sound a wee bit Scottish or Geordie, insofar as modern RP and indeed many other accents. Ow is going to emerge as oo, so we get shurers, not showers, foolers, not fowls, for instance, as you find in modern Scots and Geordie. And GH still has a value. It's not a silent sequence of letters, as it is in modern English. So it's as in modern Scots, really. Drucht, not drought. And there'll be a touch of Birmingham or Liverpool in younger, for young. In other words, if you like, in lay terms, the G is still pronounced in the NG sequence. And so on. And this is what I've opted for then. One that April with his surer sorter, the drucht of math chath persed to the rotter, and bathed every vine of switch liqueur, of which vertue engendered is the floor. When Zephyrus ache with his sweeter breath, inspired hath in every halt and hearth the tenderer crop. And specially from every shearer's end of Engeland, to Counterbury thy wend, the holy blissful master for to seeker, that him hath holpen when that thy were sake.
Our story now jumps forward 2 centuries to the Elizabethan age, a period indelibly associated in most minds with the plays of William Shakespeare. And our concept of the sounds of those times comes from performances like this.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
Without intending any disrespect for Laurence Olivier, Derek Britton believes that Hamlet might actually have sounded quite different.
This is Shakespeare, as I would imagine, with some authority, it might have been pronounced. This Shakespeare is going to sound to you rather Irish, which is not altogether surprising, since modern Southern Irish English, Hiberno English, was founded on 17th century English. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. To die, to sleep, no more. And by asleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep. To sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub.
Now, the one very striking thing about that is how much easier it is for me to follow. Not simply because of familiarity. I mean, the language is very clear to any modern listener to English, whereas Chaucer, only a couple of hundred years before, has sounded in your reading almost like a foreign language, with only the odd word detectable. What happened?
The main thing that happened, I suppose, which probably sort of separates Chaucer from the 16th century, is a phenomenon that's come to be known as the Great Vowel Shift. And that's characterised by, in particular, the high monophthongs, front and back, becoming diphthongs. So, E, for instance, in the French loan word, peep, P-I-P-E, became pape, which I've imagined Shakespeare has, on its way towards, not thoroughly established until the end of the 17th century, modern pipe. Equally, ooh, for instance, in a French loanword like doute,
had begun its progress to a diphthong, doubt, and on its way towards modern doubt, therefore.
There were changes in grammar and vocabulary as well. In Old English, there were at least six endings that denoted plurals, and many of these had survived into the age of Chaucer. But by the time of Shakespeare, these had, by and large, shrunk to just two. An S ending, as in shoes or houses, and an EN ending, as in oxen or brethren. Though, with our charming instinct for disorderliness, we did keep a few Old English irregular plurals as well, like men, women, geese, teeth, and sheep. Verbs, too, were undergoing a long and erratic process of change. Chaucer could choose between ached and oak, climbed and clomb, clue and clawed, torn and teared, and many others, but these were tending now to settle on one invariable form. The TH ending on verbs like hath and doth were becoming S endings, has and does. To find out more about how language was changing at the time, I joined Laura Wright, a lecturer at Cambridge University, examining records from Bridewell Prison in London.
This is Mary Day. She's speaking on the 2nd of April in 1575. And Mary Day has suffered from what nowadays we'd call sexual harassment. Mary Day confesseth that about Michaelmas last past, she being in her chamber and setting in her window at work, was beckoned over by one James Foreman. Whereupon she went unto him, thinking his wife had not been well, and knowing no other cause. And so she went with him into his house, and being in the hall, he said unto her, Mary, how dost thou? Where is thy husband? And Mary answers, he is gone a-shooting. And then she asked him, sir, what is your pleasure? Now notice that she doesn't say, sir, what is thy pleasure? She says, what is your pleasure? And at this date in 1575, there's a social distinction between whether you use thou or whether you use you. And James here, James Foreman, is obviously trying to be very familiar with Mary Day. We can tell that from the way he's beckoning her over. So to go on, he said he would have his pleasure of her before she went. Whereupon she said she, by fair words, entreated him and deferred the same until another time.
And when did thou drop out of
Well, it hasn't totally dropped out. There are dialects that do still use it. So you can go to parts of Yorkshire where you will still find it. But effectively, I guess it's gone really by the mid-1600s. Literature will always lag behind spoken usage. So you can see it in Shakespeare's plays, you can see it in plays later than then. But it's probably a bit of an archaistic thing, even by the time of Shakespeare.
Perhaps no other period in history has been more linguistically diverse and dynamic, more accommodating to verbal invention. It was, after all, the age not just of Shakespeare, but of Marlowe, Lilly, Spencer, Donne, Ben Jonson, Francis Bacon, Sir Walter Raleigh. In the single century up to about 1620, English gained 10,000 additional words, about half of them sufficiently useful to be with us still. Shakespeare alone created some 2,000, reclusive, gloomy, barefaced, radiance, dwindle, countless, gust, summit, to name but a few, but he was by no means alone in this unparalleled outpouring. But language never stops evolving. Some fundamental grammatical developments have happened right up to comparatively recent times. David Dennison of Manchester University turns to Jane Austen to demonstrate the point.
We have a construction which is absolutely normal. An example would be, I'm being interviewed by Bill Bryson at this very moment. I am being interviewed. I don't think anyone would notice it as being odd in any way. But Jane Austen couldn't say that. She had no, you know, the jargon is a progressive passive, though. She didn't have that structure. So she would have had to reduce it to something like, I am interviewed, would be one way that she could have got round it. Or, for a different example, rather than saying something like, supper is being prepared, she would say something like, supper is preparing. And you get structures like, the parcels were carrying down, where we would now say, were being carried down.
Now, is there a reason that changes of that nature come along?
There we're dealing with the internal structure of the language. We're dealing with the kind of change which people are not normally conscious of, and where there are various functional pressures to regularize the system, to increase the pattern regularity of the language, and so on. Partly because you couldn't say something like, I'm being obstinate. You couldn't use two occurrences of the verb be next to each other. You couldn't say, I'm being obstinate, he's being a pest, anything like that. That also came in at pretty much the same time.
From the 16th century onwards, English wasn't just growing up, it was spreading out. By the early 17th century, it had become an international tongue with the establishment of colonies in Virginia and Massachusetts. As ever with these matters, no one can say for certain what the original colonists sounded like. But at Plymouth Plantation, a recreated colonial village in Massachusetts, they work hard at conveying the sound of 17th century America as it might have been.
There's some of my neighbours, Goodman Eaton, what he comes out in Bristol.
Bristol, really?
But I do not understand he over much there when he speaks.
Well, I expect many of my neighbours say the same about myself as well. I come out of London myself.
And you?
I was born in Nottinghamshire, more to the northern part. But there, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, did we go ourselves to Holland. Now, you two lived to Amsterdam for about a year, and then there to Leiden for to dwell more than a dozen years.
And how old would you be now, then?
27.
And you?
Oh, I've got just about 18, 17 years to me, somewhere about there.
Have you or I into any young lads about the time?
Oh, no. My father, he thinks I'm a bit young yet.
Yay. That journey of English to Cape Cod was only one of many that English was taking. Here is Loretto Todd of Leeds University.
Certainly England was an incredible power, and from about the 16th century onwards, people travelled down the West African coast all the way around what later became known as Australia. They mightn't have landed in Australia for a couple of centuries, but nevertheless they went to the Far East. Incredible travelling, and sometimes when I have visited these places and I have seen where people went 300-400 years ago, it's very impressive. And wherever they went, it was obviously important for them to, they were a trading nation, and they wanted to establish ports. So all along the trade routes, as it were, you'll find ports, little places where the ships could call in. And so you find that there they often left a nucleus of English. Sometimes some sailors would stay in a port, obviously marry or live with one of the local people, but gradually you got a little core of English developing in some of the ports. And so that even in the 18th century, you had forms of English all over the world. They used to, quote, sing the song about the empire in which the sun never sets, as I'm sure you know. But as early even as the late 18th century, you had an empire, a linguistic empire, in which the sun didn't set. And English was incredibly prestigious.
As English travelled the world, it began to take on distinctively different sounds.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, in deference to you, I withdraw, but can I point out that the Leader of the Opposition hurls all sorts of abuse at me, and all through question time, these two pansies over there, what with retractions of the things which were said about them. Anyway, sit down. You're a bunch of nobodies going nowhere. Now,
do you have any idea how long it took for a recognisable Australian accent to emerge?
Without recordings, it's very difficult to say. But from the earliest recordings, let's say you have recordings going back to about the 1930s, and you have, as it were, people who thought of themselves as English, people maybe at the highest level of society, sounding unbelievably English, unbelievably Southern English, as it were. But you often found the working people with something that was a lot closer to what is now recognized as Australian English. But I think you would probably agree that the overlap between Cockney, you know, London speech, and Australian speech is fairly dramatic.
Such as?
Well, such as, for example, I can't do an Australian accent very well, but what linguists would call a dark L, if a word like railway, which might be Ryawai, so that the L almost disappears. You can get that in Cockney, you can get it in Australian English. Just as a quick example. And even a word like g'day, that die rather than day, that's something you get in London as well. Mm-hmm. You get that sort of pronunciation. Or Australian, let's talk strine. For Australian English. It's the sort of features that you get. I mean, one of the shibboleths of pronunciation is how you pronounce this word as in the rain in Spain stays mainly on the plain. I mean, that was why Shaw picked it out. The Irish, where I come from, would say the rain in Spain stays mainly on the plain, and we've got one type of pronunciation, but it goes from A to I in Australia, so the rhine and spine stays mainly on the plain, might.
Order. That fellow there is mad.
The Honourable Minister will withdraw that remark.
Can I say he's certifiable?
Order. The Honourable the Minister will withdraw both
unbalanced.
Those remarks. Will withdraw the remark. The Minister will withdraw.
I'll withdraw that and just say he's got a couple of kangaroos loose in the top paddock.
America, meanwhile, was finding its own unique ways of delivering the English language, as here in New York.
4th of July, everybody was doing shooting. They go up on the roof and shoot off guns. You don't hear any of that anymore. But them days, it was going on. Even the elections, we had more fires on the street. The fire engines had to go around and keep making them out, you know. But the kids them days were pretty wild.
That could hardly sound more different from, say, the voices of London's East End. But Robert Easton, a linguistics expert who has coached many Hollywood actors, begs to differ.
Alan Alda sent me to London to work with Bob Hoskins on a film called Sweet Liberty. And I had never met Bob before. I knew his work, certainly. And so I went to his little house in North London. And he met me and he says, "Did you find the tube station all right?" And he says, "Now," he said, "you look a little peaky. It's the old jet lag, isn't it?" He said, "What about the hotel? Do you like the hotel? Come on in, come on in." He says, I've got the tape recorder set up. He said, "I've got two copies of the script. Do you take coffee then? Do you like it with milk then?" And I thought, uh-huh, this is the man I'm going to teach to be a New Yorker.
So how do you actually go about conveying the nuances of an American accent to someone with as pronounced a London accent as Bob Hoskins?
That was relatively easy, because in the working class New York dialect, they failed to pronounce R's before consonants and pauses, much the same way as a Londoner. And in fact, the first writers who wrote about New York working class speech felicitously called it American Cockney. And in those days, it was even more like London speech than it is today. But you can hear vestigial remnants of London speech in working class New York, the way they say bottle and battle and entitled and Michael's title and mattress. You can hear an enormous number of glottal stops. They drop H's in words like "it was huge" and "he's got no sense of humor."
In the opinion of Robert Easton, even the most exotic American accent contains resonances of the very earliest forms of English.
One of our most urgent projects is to develop a national energy policy. As I pointed out during the campaign, the United States is the only major industrial country without a comprehensive, long-range energy policy. The extremely cold weather this winter has dangerously depleted our supplies of natural gas and fuel oil, and forced hundreds of thousands of workers off the job.
But do you have any idea why Southern speech has that draw? Why does it...
There are dialects in England that do have what are called fractured vowels, that where the vowel is lengthened. That goes all the way back to Anglo-Saxon times. So I think like Dayud and Hayud, there are antecedents in the British Isles.
Sheer na sheeman, sheer do for theatre. Wan under Waltnum, weop el ye shaft, quid on Kuningus fool, Christ was on Rhoda.
As English travelled around the world, it not only came to sound different in the various places it settled, but also changed in substance. I'm at Heathrow, waiting for a flight to America. Many of my fellow transatlantic travelers here will be familiar with differences in meaning between American and British English. Altogether, some 4,000 words are used differently in common speech in one country from the other, quite a considerable number, and there's great scope for embarrassment. To keep your pecker up is an indecent proposition in America, whereas a reference to a woman's fanny, which to an American is an innocent synonym for the buttocks, would at a British dinner party provoke an embarrassed silence. Sometimes the differences in meaning take on a kind of bewildering circularity. A tramp in Britain is a bum in America, while a bum in Britain is a fanny in America, while a fanny in Britain is, well, you see what I mean. To a foreigner, it must sometimes seem as if we are being intentionally contrary. Consider that in Britain, the Royal Mail delivers the post, not the mail, while in America, the Postal Service delivers the mail, not the post. Among the many thousands of words that have come into English from America are commuter, bedrock, striptease, cold spell, gimmick, babysitter, teenager, telephone, radio, to butt in, bucket shop, blizzard, and, believe it or not, stiff upper lip. But this kind of influence on the English language is not limited to America. Loretto Todd again.
You only have to think of words like, from Australian English, like kangaroo and kookaburra and boomerang and all the rest of them. We've got an incredible number of words. That's the interesting thing. Wherever English takes root, we lift words from the indigenous languages and then those words become ours. I talked to you earlier about a taboo, and I mean, that's a word from the South Pacific, tapu, meaning something that you shouldn't do, a particular thing. But what would we do without a word like that? And then we indigenize it. We turn it into an English word and it becomes a word that everybody uses, and we quickly forget that we borrowed it from the South Pacific. So that I suppose it would be easier for us to borrow words like that via Australia. People coming, as it were, back home or coming on visits would bring words like that, and then gradually they would be absorbed into the English language. I think one way in which we might notice an Australian influence would be in the use of e, you know, as a diminutive. You know how Aussie and Brizzy and that sort of thing. Now, of course, you've probably always had that in Britain and indeed in America as well. But the overlay, that's used much more widely in Australian English. Great big men using abbreviations that you might think of as diminutives in parts of the world. And yet, Kazi, for example, for a swimsuit, admittedly, that's a wee bit old-fashioned now. But nevertheless, you had men using it and so on. That sort of thing has come into Britain. And we've also started using a lot of abbreviations like that. The influence always works, I think, two ways. And I mean, again, I talked to this to some of my students who are teenagers, and they rather like spunk for a handsome young man, which they've picked up from the soap opera Neighbours. That's so strange. Somebody's a spunk. and they might know, this generation might know where they got it, but in 4 or 5 years' time, spunk will either fade or it will have become so integrated that nobody will remember that it was first used, perhaps, on the media in Australia.
Of course, just because a language becomes global doesn't mean that everyone using it will understand each other. As the comedian Arthur Smith has discovered.
Do Americans have trouble with your accent ever?
They can do, although mostly if you're in... I always sound terrible. I make myself sound English. You would sound so English when you're in New York or something. Excuse me, I don't suppose you have an apple donut, do you? Of course we got an apple donut. It's a goddamn donut shop. We got a crocodile donut. But I remember being right down in the South years ago, and I went to an ice cream place. I was in the South of America. And I said, excuse me, could I have a apple and blueberry ice cream, please? And she said, what? I said, could I have an apple and blueberry? She said, what? I said, could I? And she turned around and she said, I think this guy's French. She said, are you French? I said, so I thought there was only one way. I really wanted this blackberry and apple ice cream. So I said, could I have a blackberry and apple ice cream, please? She said, oh, sure.
The combination of the English language's mongrel pedigree and international spread led to a language that was rich in texture, but extraordinarily disorderly. Endless attempts have been made to bring order to this disorderliness. But for that, we need another program. Hello. This week we'll be looking at how English turned into such a rich and varied language, a language capable of making the following exchange possible.
Mr. Speaker, will you confirm that you actually have the power to order the fat bounder to be dragged from the dinner table?
Order! Well, order! Well, order! First of all, order! I haven't got the power, and I dislike that expression, which I will ask the Honourable Gentleman to withdraw, please.
Well, in that case, corpulent gentleman to actually...
Almost as bad.
Corpulent and right Honourable Gentleman to be brought here in a tumbrel, Mr. Speaker.
The Labour MP, Tony Banks, searching for the right words to describe his parliamentary opponent, Nigel Lawson. If English has a delightful capacity for subtle expressiveness, an ability to say one thing and mean quite another, it also has a capacity for bewildering density. Here is Gordon Brown, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, explaining, well, I'm not sure what he's explaining.
Now, our new economic approach does not simply require us to adapt to changes in the practical world. It is also rooted in changes in the world of economic ideas. The growth of post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory and the symbiotic relationships that people now understand.
As we saw in our first two programs, English has both benefited from and been complicated by its mongrel heritage. Successive waves of linguistic invaders, the Anglo-Saxons, the Vikings, the Norman French, have left us with a multi-layered language that is particularly rich in terms. No one actually knows how many words there are in English. The Oxford English Dictionary contains 615,000 entries, about twice as many as the largest French, German, or Spanish dictionaries. But in fact, if you add in all the terms that don't make it into even an unabridged dictionary like the OED, the proper nouns, the more obscure scientific and mathematical terms, then the number is very much larger, probably not less than 3 or 4 million. Indeed, it can be argued that there are too many words in English. After all, do we really need a word like glabrous when we already have hairless, or sternutation in preference to sneezing, or quotidian for ordinary? The wealth of synonyms and the fractional degrees of difference that sometimes distinguish them can be confusing, as the novelist Marika Kobold discovered when she began learning English as a young girl in Sweden.
I do remember my English teacher at primary school, who was also the headmistress, very early on teaching us the social nuances, and that amused me because I don't think I ever came across that in any other foreign language I learned. You know, that I think it's best, children, if you say lavatory and not toilet, and I think English people really prefer if you say napkin and not serviette. And I remember reacting to that even as a comparatively young child.
And do you not have that sort of thing in Swedish?
Not to that degree, really. I mean, one big difference is that you have more words, simply that. You have many more words in English than you have in Swedish. If you look up at thesaurus here, you'll find maybe 3 or 4 different words that describe the same thing, whereas in Swedish it might only be one. So you have a clumsier vehicle, really, a clumsier tool.
English is so rich indeed that we need all manner of dictionaries to capture it. Medical dictionaries, engineering dictionaries, computer dictionaries, since no one dictionary could possibly convey it all. Jonathan Green has spent much of the last few years picking his way through one of the more interestingly arcane areas of English lexicography, slang. Ironically, he finds it hard to define his own subject.
I find it very difficult to define slang. Etymologically, it actually comes from a Swedish or Scandinavian word which means thrown. Same word as gives us sling, and it's thrown language. That is one of the theories. Another is it's the language of criminals because it's the slang which means, slangs actually mean chains, and it's the rattling of the chains, figuratively, symbolically, whatever. But what it really is, it's the language of, it's an alternative to the standard. That's how I see it. It's also a linguistic two fingers or one finger, depending on which country you come from, a gesture of disdain, thumbing the nose to the standard English. It's a release. It's a relief. It's enormously enjoyable. It's a very rich language. It's so difficult. I mean, a word like tanner, meaning sixpence, when we didn't have before decimal coinage. That was slang. Lots of people used it. They probably didn't even know it was slang, but it was. If I look at a late 16th century moll whopper pace, I know that's slang. Moll means a scrubber, basically. Whop means to have sexual intercourse, and a pace is standard English meaning fast. So what it means is, you know, she is a girl who, I suppose, has sex quickly. I mean, that's slang. You would not use that in standard English. It is not formal. It is not polite. Slang tends to be impolite, I think. Slang also changes. If you look in 1711, when Jonathan Swift is writing a letter, which I shall paraphrase as something like, for the reform of the English language, he is saying that mob is slang, that bamboozle is slang, that elisions like couldn't and wouldn't are slang. And those in 1711, as far as he was concerned, were slang. But this is a period when, shortly afterwards, Dr. Johnson would define the word illiterate as not knowing Greek and Latin. It is very difficult with language. It tends to be from various people's point of view. I'm amazed that mob should ever have been thought of as slang, but in 1711 it was.
Was slang richer in former times? Was it more productive?
I like the old stuff, but some of the new stuff can be absolutely wonderful. I mean, I think harpic is wonderful. Harpic, which means mad. Why is harpic mad? Harpic is mad because it's clean around the bend.
One of the more indelicate areas of slang, indeed of language generally, is obscenities. But an obscenity today wasn't necessarily an obscenity in the past.
I mean, a very good example, there's a couple of good examples. One is the word bollocks, which people, I think, would... It's used to mean rubbish in a relatively colloquial way, but on the whole... You know, when you get kicked in the bollocks or whatever it is, that's slang.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that if you go back to a dictionary or a glossary, to be more precise, a Latin Anglo-Saxon glossary prepared by a man called Abbot Aelfric, which I think around approximately 1,000 years ago, he translates, I think the word is something like testes, as bealukos, which means very obviously bollocks. Once again, there is the word podex, which he translates as, well, he spells it A-R-C-E-H-O-O-L-E, which we know as arsehole. I mean, those words were accepted.
But to find the nerve center, as it were, of the English language, lexical HQ, so to speak, you must travel to Oxford, to the headquarters of the world's largest and most revered collection of words, the great and noble Oxford English Dictionary. John Simpson, the OED's general editor, took time to show me around.
Well, we're now in the centre of the OED editorial department, which is largely open plan. There are about 80 staff on either side of us. This is an area where there's editors revising the existing texts of the dictionary. Moving on over there, there's an area where the bibliographical group are working. Etymology is a bit further along. There's a new word section somewhere as well.
And when will you have the revision done?
It'll be completed by 2010, according to the present schedule. So it's a long-term major international project.
So how many headwords are there in the OED now, and how many do you expect there to be in the revised edition?
Well, there are about $250,000 at the moment. I should think probably 350,000, but you'll be dealing with about 1 million defined terms, I expect. We're now in an area of the OED where people are working on the revision of non-scientific terminology, and Olivia is one of the staff members who's working on particular parts of the alphabet at the moment.
And so what exactly are you looking at here, Olivia?
Well, recently I've been working on plant. In this part of the screen, this is where I actually do the editing. In this part, that's how it actually looks. We'll look on the page. These are the tags.
In an atmosphere that seems to owe more to Silicon Valley than to the bookish world of academe, for there are no great piles of papers here, no teetering stacks of musty volumes, only a kind of clinical neatness. In this atmosphere, Olivia Duncan quietly works her way through boxes of note cards, sifting data provided for her by various specialist departments, scientists, etymologists, a news team whose members coordinate a database of citations sent in from readers from around the world. All this is needed to enable Olivia to revise the entry for the word plant.
Here you are. Now, this is an extra sense of plant, which news have added in. So it's to place a bomb in a building, especially as a terrorist act, or to place a kiss. And then that will then get incorporated at the very end into what I've done.
I'm with you.
That's incredible.
So it is incredible.
For you, how long...
How long does one range take?
Or actually one word?
One word. It can vary enormously. Very often, long words look as though they're going to give you terrible problems. And they don't always. What causes the problems is if the senses are very close. It can be very hard to distinguish between them. I revised perfect a while back, and that took me a long time, about 10 days.
Really?
Yeah. Because it was long and the senses were difficult to distinguish.
One aspect of English that often troubles people of an orderly bent is that it is forever changing. Words alter meaning over time, often diametrically. Nice, for instance, originally meant stupid or foolish. Then, at various times, it came to mean lascivious or wanton, extravagant, slothful, elegant, slight, precise, and thin. Not until the 18th century did it take on the modern sense of pleasant and agreeable. Most words in English experience some drift in meaning. The technical term is catachresis, to the severe annoyance of those who equate change with decline. It has been this way for a long time, as I learned from David Dennison of Manchester University. People commonly feel that the English language is going to hell in a way at a rate that it never has before. Is that true?
Nope. And they've always felt that, you know, nostalgia ain't what it used to be. There is no period of English that we know of when people were interested in the language at all when there haven't been complaints about change. I think the first real awareness of linguistic issues is around the time of Chaucer. Chaucer writes in manuscripts that he hopes scribes don't miswrite it because there is so much change going on. We go to the 17th, 18th centuries, you know, the attempts to fix the language, to stop it changing, to resist change, to complain about terrible new words like fan and mob and so on. People have always complained about change. I'm not aware that things are any worse now than they used to be.
The way words are used, the grammar and structure of a language, changes too. I asked David Dennison where the notorious stricture about not ending a sentence with a preposition came from.
As far as I know, I think the received wisdom is that it was Dryden, in revising some of his writing, unsure whether he should use constructions like the story of which I have been told, or the story which I have been told of, did what would have been normal in his time, which was to translate it into Latin to see what Latin would do, found that in Latin you didn't normally strand prepositions at the end of a sentence, and decided, well, in case of doubt, go with Latin, went through all his work, doing his best to revise to the new form, and that this particular stricture was taken up by the grammarians of English in the 18th century and elevated into a rule. Whereas in fact, historically, the form with the preposition late is much older than the form where the preposition comes right at the beginning.
When such change can be seen happening around us, we tend to regard it as a retrograde step. I, for my part, wince at the loss of distinction between imply and infer, uninterested and disinterested, anticipate and expect. Any moderately discerning user of English will have his own list of bugbears.
Well, frankly, the problem as I see it at this moment in time is whether I should just lie down under all this hassle and let them walk all over me, or whether I should just say, okay, I get a message and do myself in.
The question, though, is to what extent we resist change in language and to what extent we accommodate it. John Honey is an educator and the author of a book arguing for a fairly strict adherence to conventions, what is generally known as standard English.
Standard English has been the method of communication amongst people of any kind of education for hundreds of years. If you didn't speak it, if you used non-standard grammar and peppered your conversation with non-standard vocabulary, then people could assume that you hadn't had a high degree of education. That expectation, of course, is now universal. So if people say we was, or them thinks it's nice, we make a judgment about the extent of their education. It's the least educated people who show the most signs of using non-standard grammar, non-standard vocabulary.
Some people, however, believe that standard English is elitist, that it is used as a way of excluding non-standard English speakers from mainstream life. John Honey thinks the opposite is true.
Many linguists have argued for 30 years that one of the bad things about teaching standard English, white, Anglo-Saxon, middle-class speech, is that it is exclusive. It serves to exclude others. Quite wrong, says my book. Standard English is the only one that is not exclusive. All the others are exclusive. You and I can't learn black English. There are no textbooks. There are no linguaphone recordings. Nobody is going to offer to teach us black English. And if we try to speak black English, it will be resented because the outsiders' attempts to speak a non-standard variety are usually regarded as involving some kind of mockery or condescension. So they are the exclusive ones. The Lancashire dialect is exclusive. The Cockney dialect is exclusive. However hard you try, Bill, or I try, we're not going to be able to make it. And our attempts to do so will not earn us the thanks of those people who genuinely speak them from birth. It is the language of birth. It is the language of exclusion, non-standard English. I want to oppose mechanisms of exclusion. It's the language, say the linguists, of working class solidarity, or rather council estate solidarity, or ghetto solidarity. And I say we should be trying in society to move away from the solidarities, the arbitrarily allocated solidarities of the mine, the pit, of the council estate, of the ghetto. We ought to liberate people so that they can operate at any level of society, in any region of society, not trapped by the speech forms which immediately identify them as only coming from there.
What about the argument that, perhaps that's so, but what about the argument that in other ways they are richer or more expressive, that, for instance, in black street slang, by using double negatives you get an additional emphasis can't achieve in standard
English? That's right. Some of them have some riches, as you have mentioned. Glaswegian English, they have wonderful, humorous potential in Glaswegian English. Now, you've got all kinds of humorous potential in standard English, but here you've got an extra dimension if you can add that one. But what it doesn't say is that for 1,000 common objectives of human communication, such as arguing your corner, asserting your rights, gaining respect, getting a job, filling up an application form, for all those purposes, your non-standard dialect is going to be of little avail to you.
In his, shall we say, livelier moments, Professor Honey accuses academics like Loretto Todd of Leeds University of a brand of dangerous liberalism, a willingness to distort and weaken English for the benefit of non-standard speaking minorities. In fact, as I found when I went to visit Dr. Todd, the chasm between them is not as great as all that.
I think you have to make it clear to children, and how a good teacher does it is not something I would want to interfere with, but you have to make it clear to a child that just as if they're sitting down to a meal, it is easier for them if they use a knife and fork on meat rather than a spoon. I mean, theoretically, you could use a spoon, but it's easier to do certain things. The Yorkshire form of English is no better and no worse than the standard form of English, but it is the standard form of English that is the international norm. And I suppose what I would say is the teacher must somehow be able to say to the children, the form that you're using is perfectly acceptable in your homes, it's perfectly acceptable in the familiar circumstances in which you are. But in terms of an education, for better or for worse, the form that you will be examined on in tests and all the rest of it is the standard medium. But it doesn't mean that you have to tell a child that his or her mother tongue, the variety they use in the home, is inadequate. It may not be the variety to use in the educational sphere, but it's not in any way inadequate.
In Britain, far more than in other English-speaking countries, pronunciation comes into the equation. In America, how you pronounce words may fix you geographically. Here they fix you socially as well. As Laura Wright of Cambridge explains, it's a combination of words and accent.
You can't really, I mean you can, but nobody ever does, speak Yorkshire dialect with an RP accent. How would it go? Yesterday I were stuck in traffic jam and I were stood at corner. I mean, it's artificial, mm-hmm. You know. Whereas doing it the other way round, the inverse, you know, using standard English syntax and vocabulary, but with a Yorkshire accent, that's very, very common. Because that then begins to correlate with the classes. So as a speech community, what we do is we judge those people who use, say, I don't know, a Yorkshire dialect and a Yorkshire set of vocabulary plus a Yorkshire accent as being working class people from Yorkshire. Whereas those people who speak a standard English syntax with a standard English set of vocabulary but a Yorkshire accent, we would judge as being more middle class. After all, you can get that on the regional news bulletins. And then those people who speak a standard English syntax, a standard English set of vocabulary and an RP accent, they are non-regionally marked. You cannot tell where they come from. They probably come from Kenya, you know, you can't tell. Because they're that tiny percentile of upper middle class and upper class people. I think it's estimated at something like 7 to 8% of the population. They're the ones who own all the money. They're the ones who went to the public schools. And for them, their accent is non-regionally marked. But for all other speakers, we're regionally marked.
Even at the more refined levels of life, a distinctive accent can sometimes be regarded as a kind of misfortune, as Loretta Todd discovered.
When I first started in Leeds as a young lecturer, one of the professors said to me, "Do you not think your accent would be a handicap?" And my attitude was, as long as the students can understand me, how on earth can it be a handicap? I am me. I'm not an RP speaker. I am not from a particular slice of English society. I'm not knocking those people. If that's your accent naturally, good luck to you. But it's not mine. And I mean, I am quintessentially a Northern Ireland person and tremendously happy with that. So why should I not make it overt in my speech?
There are those, like the comedian Arthur Smith, who have learned to capitalise on a distinctive regional speech form.
My brother and I brought up at a very similar time, and he's now the editor of the British Medical Journal and is an establishment figure. And he and I have similar accents, but his wafts a little bit more towards the classical received pronunciation, whereas I, as a performer and comedian, have chosen a broader accent. I mean, we do sound quite similar, but there's no doubt that his is a bit posher than mine. And, you know, but he retains it. He was once invited to Buckingham Palace, and his wife was in the toilet and overheard two women speaking about my brother and saying, "Oh, yes, that Dr. Richard Smith, he's very nice, but he's rather gore-blimey, isn't he?" If, you know, the very first time I went on stage, one of the things about me was my accent. It was quite a strong accent, a strong London accent compared to most people. And so I would naturally choose that because that already was a sort of statement, it was a ready-made statement that I was, you know, people make assumptions about some sort of wide boy, East End, you know, bit of a lad, fast-talking, patter merchant, you know, almost the sort of man you see, you rather admire their verbal skills of selling, you know, ripped-off perfume at street corners, that kind of cockney patter type thing. So I chose that because it was something to work with and against. But I don't think I did it consciously. I think I felt that I would be funnier with that accent or more striking.
You must spend quite a lot of your life around people, clearly, who don't have a South London working-class accent. And do you find that just the constant exposure to that rubs the edges off your own accent?
I think it does a bit, yeah. I used to say the word dull, which maybe the radio callers will know what that means. It's dull is probably, and how I've ended up saying it, because in the East End it was dull. You know, is my Cindy dull? And I found myself being not understood by people. So in the end, I said dull. at some point. That one I do vaguely remember consciously thinking, right, I'm going to say doll.
Well, perhaps they were just puzzled because you had a Cindy doll.
No, it's quite common round my way. We're all very advanced.
One striking feature of English is that we've never had a governing body like the Académie Française in France to try to regulate it. English just blunders along, or to put it more generously, evolves without restraint. Most people see this as a good thing. Loretto Todd.
My feeling is that you cannot pontificate changes. There's no such thing as the language in any case without people. And people will do with the language what they want to do with the language. Change is a sign that a language is alive and kicking. I mean, Latin's not changing very much, but Latin's dead. I don't think we would want the same thing to happen to English.
I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, I mean, I see looking around here that you have compiled and written books on punctuation, dictionary of English usage, and so on, which would seem to imply that you feel that these things are important and worth pushing for.
I think you've got to maintain the standard language. But I'm a great believer in saying every single speaker that I know has a range of Englishes. They have what an old linguist once called the language of slippered ease, when you can be yourself. You don't have to worry about your P's and Q's. That's a style. And then you've got other styles. If you're being formal, you will use a formal style. And what I would like to say is that it's important for us to maintain the formal style for formal interaction. But to try and make people use the one style for every purpose would be the equivalent of trying to make us all dress in grey. What an incredibly dull world it would be.
Indeed. If there's one thing about English to be admired and cherished, it is its almost infinite capacity not to be dull. And that, I'm happy to tell you, is a subject we shall turn to next week.
Is it possible to make an anagram out of my name, Bill Bryson?
Let's have a look. Let's take out the word lobby and see what's left. Only one vowel left. let's try Brolly. You're used to the English Brolly, aren't you? Brolly bins? Where you keep your umbrellas?
Brolly bins. That's incredible. Can you try to see what you can make of mother tongue?
That looks a tough one. Well, we could say, tour the gnome, I suppose.
Tour the gnome.
The gnome tour.
The gnome tour.
Gnome tour.
So, hello. This is Brolly Bins presenting the gnome tour. With a little help there from crossword puzzle expert and inveterate anagramist Roy Dean, from whom more later. If there is one thing about English that we can all be proud of, it is its remarkable affection for wordplay. There exist in English varieties of wordplay almost beyond counting. Puns, palindromes, tongue twisters, cryptograms, crossword puzzles, anagrams, rebuses, clarihues, you name it. Of course, every language in the world indulges in wordplay of some sort, but no speech group has invented more varieties or brought them to a higher level than those who speak English. And in this, I am happy to concede, the British are without peer.
Can I do you now, sir? I've got another follower now, sir. He's a gunner.
Oh, is he? I bet you make him come out of his shell.
Oh, yes, sir. He says I'm a wicked little barrage.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy. Yes, sure. Come for fitting, have you?
Yes, I've been sent up by the producer.
I'm not surprised, Duncan.
Four candles.
Here you are. Four candles.
No, four candles.
Well, there you are, four candles.
No, four candles. Handles for forks.
It's not painting, it's passed on.
This parrot is no more. It's ceased to be. It has expired. The parrot has gone to meet its maker. This is a late parrot.
Why is it, I've long wondered, that the British are so good at this verbal dexterity? Is there something in the language that encourages a playful character? Or is it something in their character that makes them find playfulness in the language? I put the question to Tony Ogard, author of the Oxford Guide to Wordplay.
This is a very nice thing about the British, I think particularly. They do like to mess about with everything. They can't take things seriously. And they're given the wonderful, serious English language, which is the greatest gift that could be given to any person. And what do? With it? They start turning the words back to front and making palindromes, and they make up anagrams. They'll shuffle the letters around. They'll play with the sounds of the words. They'll play with the meanings of the words. They'll create games that you can play on television, like Call My Bluff, which is a very old dictionary game. Mm-hmm. And they just won't be serious. And I think that's a wonderful characteristic.
Merryboke, Alan Corran.
As you know, I love doing Call My Bluff. I love it because I get to meet actors. The only problem is I can't shake their hands. I'm very uneasy about shaking their hands because there are so many veterinary series on television today. When you reach out, you think, I know that, it's been up a cow quite recently. And worst of all, you might run into someone who's been dealing with pigs. Because a Merryboke is an ulcerous tumour inside the intestine of a pig.
It's one of the great joys, of course, of English. I do this silly programme every day on television, Call My Bluff. Can't do it in Germany.
Really? No, that wasn't very actually a question. Why not?
You can't. It's not a rich enough language. The academicians in France have cleaned the language out. So you don't have these enormously rich puns. But you don't have the OED. You don't have you don't have a million words. There are infinite possibilities, and so many of them sound funny. And in other languages, words don't really sound funny. I don't know what it is, but I know. I tried reading, because my German's not bad, reading Woodhouse in German. And they translated, remember this very clearly, they translated ice formed on the butler's upper slopes, literally. And it doesn't work, because it sounds like a mountain. Yeah. It doesn't sound like a man. It's simply the overtones of a language that has drawn on so much for so long and has so many words for everything. I mean, it's part of the nature of England to produce synonyms. I mean, I studied Anglo-Saxon, and it was a simple culture. They didn't talk about much. They talked about swords and the sea and death. But they had 90 words for sword and 200 words for the sea and 1,000 words for death.
One of Britain's funniest writers, Alan Corran. One thing is certain, wordplay in English is as old as English itself. Ray Page, Emeritus Professor of Anglo-Saxon Studies at Cambridge University.
There are a number of riddles in Old English, and some of them have double meanings, and I suppose this double meaning is intended. Here's an example. I'll read it in the Old English first, and it's in verse. Bret lich hongath beweras theo, freon under sheata. Foran is thurl, with steeth and heard, stay the haveth goodna. And I say, esna his argan rail over cane heveth, will that coo the hole mid his hangalan hevda greaten, that he everlang ere oft yfilde. Now, a literal translation of this. There's a remarkable thing hanging by a man's thigh under the tunic of the chap. At the front of it, there's a hole. It is stiff and hard, and it has a splendid place. When this man lifts up his own coat, lifts it up over his knee, then it wants to visit that well-known hole with his hanging thing that he often has done before. Now, what is being referred to here? Can you have a guess?
Some kind of tool, perhaps?
Yes, indeed. Yes, you're quite right. Can you be more precise?
I couldn't begin to guess.
Oh, it means a key, of course.
A key?
You thought it meant something else to you? Well, this is the Anglo-Saxon's idea of a joke, and I may say the original of this is in Exeter Cathedral Library.
In order to research his book on wordplay, Tony Ogard hunted through literature looking for references. Not surprisingly, he found them everywhere.
Somebody counted up that Shakespeare used 3,000 puns in his plays. And even at the most serious times, Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet says, "Ask for me tomorrow and I shall be a grave man." And that's just before he's, just as he's dying. So Shakespeare shoved in these puns just at the worst moment, when Macbeth was killing people or Hamlet was throwing his sword in all directions. And ever since, and even before Shakespeare, people were messing about with the language. You get references in Thackeray and Jane Austen, to various word games in Pepys's diary, things like that.
What did Pepys write about?
He said that they played Crambo on a journey somewhere, and Crambo is a game where you give somebody a word that rhymes with a word they've got to guess. It's a rather childish game, actually, but you say, "I'm thinking of a word for an animal that rhymes with a log," and then they had to think of dog, you see. It's probably not as basic as that when Pepys was playing it, but that's the sort of game that they played to while away the long hours.
And so it has continued into modern times. Perhaps the greatest addition of our own century to the art of wordplay has been the crossword puzzle. It was invented by an Englishman named Arthur Wynne. Wynne lived in New York, and so the very first crossword, or word cross as Wynne called it, appeared in the New York World newspaper on December 21st, 1913. Wynne's crossword required the solver simply to supply a word that matched a brief definition. And for the most part, in America, the crossword has never really much advanced from that. But in Britain, it became a much more challenging and cerebral enterprise, requiring mastery of cryptic clues, puns, anagrams, embedded words, lexical red herrings, and any number of other verbal traps. It requires a certain fiendish turn of mind to get really good at this, and no one has ever got better than a mild-mannered retired civil servant from Bromley in Kent named Roy Dean. In 1970, he solved a Times crossword in 3 minutes and 45 seconds, a feat that has never been bettered.
Okay, Roy, this is today's Times crossword, number 20,615, for the record. I just wonder if you can guide me through a few of the clues, because I'm absolutely clueless at these.
Well, this is Monday morning, so it should be the easiest one of the week. Crossword editor arranges that to give everyone a good start. Now, if we take one across. One across says, "Dear me, it set back all the players." Well,
it's five letters.
This is a five letters. Now, this is an example of word building. You have to think of "it set back" is obviously T-I, so it's going to end in T-I. What's an expression meaning "dear me"? Well, "tut," for example. So you get the "tut" and the T-I making "tutti," which is all the players in the orchestra. So always in the clue there's a definition, and usually there's another way of arriving at the answer.
I know that there are some publications in America that run cryptic crosswords, and so clearly there are people who do it, but it's nothing like the national passion it is here. Is there something about the British character, you think, that accounts for this love of messing around with words?
Well, it's partly the fact that the words are there to be messed around with. You've got so many words of meanings. I think the word "set" has something like 200 meanings. Every single part of speech is there in the word "set," three letters. And because English is a melting pot, we're taking words from all languages, and you get words that can be pronounced in different ways. The fact is that if you look at an English word, most words will break down into segments, or one word inside another. Take the word "cabaret," for example. It's bear inside cat.
Of course it is.
So the crossword compiler looking like that would say it shows a nude in indecent act. Act, again, being the anagram for cat.
And the indecent tells you...
Say that it's an anagram. Mm. Or improper. Improper would be better. You had an improper act seen here.
Is it possible to play with words in the same way in other languages, as far as you know?
I think it would be possible to play with language in the sound of sounds. You have certain sounds in French, for example, where you can pun in French on the sound of words. But I don't really believe any other language is as flexible as English to allow this deconstruction of the words into sections and one word inside another and so on. And you certainly couldn't do it in any of the sort of pictogram languages, Japanese, Chinese and so on. I doubt if you could do it in Russian. English is absolutely unique. Here's Mrs. Moss.
One of the more curiously challenging forms of wordplay is the palindrome. Words or sentences that read the same backward or forward, as in a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Roy Dean, not satisfied with mere sentences, devised a palindromic poem of 72 lines, the wordplay equivalent of swimming the English Channel.
Well, here's one stanza of the poem. It has about 12 lines. To establish that it's a port, the first line is the name of the ship. Netta Delia, sailed at 10. Niagara, fall afar again. Riraxac, can snack, cast Kera. A rare medoc, O demerara. Murder noses on red rum. Mum, it poses optimum. To predicate, go get a cider pot. Toll a renegade, bed the general lot to claret. Alas, it is a lateral cot.
Now you might possibly dismiss this passion for messing about with words as a waste of time and an irrelevance. Not so. At Bletchley Park in Buckinghamshire, during the Second World War, the very skills and lateral mental processes that made the British so adept at crosswords were put to use to break the famous German Enigma code. The success of the Bletchley Park codebreakers is thought to have shortened the war by at least 2 years. Today, Bletchley Park is in the process of being converted into a large-scale museum. It was there I met Tony Sale, its director.
So, Bill, this is the mock-up of an intercept room here, and this is where the important German radio signals were listened to by people crouched over receivers trying to extract the very faint German signals from the ether. So, if we put this receiver on here... Ah, we've got some Morse code straight away. There we are. So this is what the operator would be listening to here, trying to write down this Morse code, which would have been the German signal, which, of course, they then had to decipher. But, of course, that signal actually came from an Enigma machine, and here we have a German Enigma machine. And this is the machine which was generating the cipher, which we had to try and break. And the total number of combinations on just this, on a three-wheel Enigma, and this is a four-wheel one, but just on a three-wheel Enigma, is 150 million, million, million.
So how on earth did they manage it, and how long did it take them?
Well, the amazing thing is, first of all, they managed it at all, but secondly, the Germans changed the code settings every night at midnight. So all bets off, start again, 150 million, million, million choices. And they reckoned they hadn't done very well in Bletchley Park if they hadn't found the key, amazingly, by 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, it's always seemed to me that one of the reasons that the British are so good at code breaking is because they have this background and love for wordplay.
Mm, absolutely.
Is that too much of an assumption?
That's absolutely right, and I'm sure that was all part of it. I mean, some of the top people here were exceptionally brilliant. Peter Hilton is reputed to be able to have done the Sunday Times crossword in his head without writing it down.
Really?
I mean, that's that sort of level of people. And he could hold a string of letters about sort of 20 or 30 long in his mind's eye and slip one set against another and look for correlations in his head. So that was the level of sort of people who were here. But certainly wordplay and that side of it was very, very important indeed.
Now, I understand that crossword puzzles played a role in recruitment here.
Oh, yes, indeed. The recruiters looked for people who were good at chess, at anagrams, and crosswords. And one remarkable story is that one gentleman named Stanley Sedgwick, he was a managing clerk in a small firm in London, and it's happened that the Daily Telegraph ran a competition, a crossword competition, and Stanley was very good at crosswords. And this competition was for anybody who could complete a Daily Telegraph crossword in under 12 minutes. So Stanley went in for this competition, and he put the result in, or had the result authorised, and he was amazed to find, landing on his doormat about a week or so later, a summons to go to somebody in the Foreign Office for an interview. And he went, and that's how he came to Bletchley Park. And he worked in MacVitie's section, which was breaking the German Met codes, and he worked there the whole of the war.
English is a democratic language, and toying inventively with words is not limited to the more rarefied strata of the intellectual world. Indeed, one of the most delightful and enduring forms of wordplay emerged rather lower down the social scale. I refer to Cockney rhyming slang, parodied here by Ronnie Barker.
As he staggered along, he saw, there on the pavement, a small brown Richard III. And he stared at it, lying there at his plates of meat. And he picked it up. And he put it on top of the wall where no one could step on it. And a rich 4x2-ish merchant who witnessed the deed put his hand into his skyrocket and took out a Lady Godiva and handed it to the man, saying, "I saw you pick up that Richard III. And that was a kindly act. Pray take this Lady Godiva for your froth and bubble." And the man took it and went on his way rejoicing. And the small brown Richard III flew back to its nest.
Lexicographer Jonathan Green has devoted years to investigating slang of all types for a soon-to-be-published dictionary.
How long has rhyming slang been with us?
It would appear to come on stream around the middle of the 19th century. It's sort of East End market tradesman language that emerged during that period, and it's gone on ever since.
Right, and were they using it for their own amusement or as a kind of code?
I think as a kind of code. You see, there are other slangs at that period that have, on the whole, vanished, and backslang is one of them, and a refinement of that butcher's backslang.
Which is?
In which you say bemal instead of lamb. Well, I've actually heard it. I mean, once somebody used the word, I think something like thebe instead of beef, and I was in absolute heaven for the whole day. I wanted to say to this man, thank you. But I think on the whole it's died, nonetheless. It was a rather old man.
How many different slang? Rhyming slang expressions did you come up with for your book?
I've got around 1,700, and I doubt for a second that that is comprehensive, because they come and go, but that's the ones I've picked up.
What are some of the more recent ones, then?
There's Ayrton, as in Ayrton Senna, the racing driver. Ayrton Senna means a tenner, means a £10 note. We've got barley here, which is actually short for oats and barley. Oats and barley, it's a double one, this, because oats and barley rhymes with Charlie. Charlie means cocaine. So a line of barley is a line of cocaine. Bradleys, which comes from Brad Pitt, which rhymes with tit. So a nice pair of Bradleys. Howard's Way, which Howard it is, I wouldn't know, but Howard's, I presume it came from the Ian Forster book, but Howard's Way means gay. He's a bit of a Howard. And on it goes. I mean, there's a number of them. Leo Sayer means an all-day drinking session, and apparently Leo Sayer rhymes with all-dayer. So you're off for a quick Leo, or a lengthy Leo, it would probably be.
Right.
Jonathan gave us many more examples, most of them, alas, unbroadcastable. A striking feature of English literature is the extent to which its leading writers have used humour, from Chaucer to Dickens and beyond. Nearly all the greatest names in the literary firmament have been distinguished in some measure by a mastery of wit and wordplay. There cannot be another country where the ability to make people laugh is quite so venerated. I put the matter to Alan Corran.
One of the things that most impressed me when I first came to Britain was the humour. And there seemed to be this kind of humour that was based on wordplay that I had never really encountered in the same way in the States when I was growing up. Even movies like the Carry On films most of the humour, a very large part of it, was based on puns and double entendres.
Well, it was innuendo, and that's why English is so wonderfully smutty. Things in English somehow, and I've never been able to understand why, if they are put in a context where a nudge is expected, they will become funny, which is to say you can call a penis anything. You can say, oh, he's a man, he had an enormous Norman. Oh, my God, have you seen the size of that Bernard? Or she had an amazing pair of, what shall we call them, mop dinners. And you think, why is it funny? But it actually is. And it sort of doesn't work in American. American doesn't have innuendo in quite the same way. A lot of that is to do with the tradition of demotic musical comedy. Shakespeare is shot through with it. You know, thou horse unzed, thou unnecessary letter, or, you know, thou Jacob. The Porter speech is a Max Miller routine. Launcelot Gobbo, Falstaff, Nim, Bardolph, all these people are straight situation comedy, Carry On, knockabout.
Now, what about the other strand of English humour that struck me when I first came here, and that's this love of nonsense? I mean, things like Jabberwocky, and that, you know, makes absolutely no sense, but is still amusing.
That's just about the language being funny.
Yeah, but
it just... and the language being so funny that you can actually invent it, and it sounds like English. You can come up with chortle because you want something that just happens to fit the grin, chuckle, all the rest. You make it up; it passes into the language, brillig and slithy. All English words are components of sounds which are themselves potentially very funny. And though we've already said that it's the richest language in the world, still not rich enough for the fantasists. They still carry on making up stuff. They still come up with brillig and Jabberwocky.
'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome raths outgrabe.
It's very hard to think of a figure in British English literature that isn't also funny. I mean, it seems
totally
to be...
true, absolutely true, all the way through from the novels. I mean, starting with Chaucer and going through, if you think of the great heroes of English lit, the writers who are Richardson, Thackeray, Sterne, amazing, Tristram Shandy, astonishing at that time to a huge comic novel, and then on through through that 19th century, which is just comedy, while the Russians are producing Lermontov and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and the French are producing Balzac, you know, Flaubert. What we're producing is Thomas Love Peacock, Jane Austen, Dickens, Thackeray. It's quite astonishing. It is a very rich comic tradition that really pours through 800 years of continuous comedy.
What is it? I mean, is there something in the British character that encourages that kind of writing?
I know that the British, not just the English, the British response to disorder is to survive it by laughing at it. It's Arthur Moe Kaiser. I mean, Punch's great strengths were the Depression, the First World War, the Second World War. Its sales were enormous. People turned to humour. It is something to do with a stiff upper lip and a lower lip trembling with laughter simultaneously.
There is another way to be funny in English, unwittingly. Here's Julie Walters reading the instructions on the back of an Italian food packet.
Bring in cannelloni as they are, a stuffing macked with beef, eggs, papa or spices, all well amalgamated and juicy. Besmear a backing pan and after dispose the cannelloni lightly distanced between them in an only couch.
English, as we all know, has become a global language, the most successful the world has ever known, spoken as a mother tongue by more than 350 million people, and by many more as a second tongue. But for that, we need another program. Or, as Roy Dean might say, a meager thorn romp. Hello. This week we're looking at how English has spread around the world and at its effect on other peoples and cultures. How, for example, did this extraordinary form of English emerge in West Africa?
Now, who are the Siso?
Na mio.
This na your eye.
And me, my brother, which na go do. You know, say work plenty. No rest, nothing. Every time I day for work.
Now, you go hide yourself.
You don't see me now, which you get for tell me.
Says you don't drive, sir.
Now, work, as I tell you.
For the answer, I went to Leeds University to meet Loretto Todd, an authority on world Englishes. Unfortunately, I neglected to brush up on my pidgin.
Aha, na so, na who de? Aha, na Bill, my brother, how you de?
I'm very well, thank you. You must be Loretto Todd.
Na so, how country, Bill? Country fine?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you plenty. Me too, I fine bad. Me a there for Leeds. For which place you been come out this morning?
I came this morning from York.
Where are you to go today?
Today, then from here we go on to Leicester.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, me, I get for she down here for Leeds. I go stay here sote, but I like I'm bad.
me
You're hungry bad? Hungry to do you?
Hungry real bad, yes.
Aha. Uh-huh. I think say then we fit chop. No be so?
Chop sounds great.
Okay. I think say we go chop. That one fine? You go do?
A pidgin is a rudimentary language that emerges when people from two different language groups come together, usually for purposes of trade or commerce. When contact between those two groups is prolonged, the pidgin will sometimes evolve into a more formalized tongue known as a creole. To the uninitiated, there is a tendency to regard both pidgins and creoles as rather comical, substandard languages. In fact, as Loretto Todd makes clear, they are, in their way, as sophisticated and expressive as any other language in the world, sometimes more so.
The pidgin in various West African countries is very special in that it's a type of halfway house between their own culture and the European culture, if you like. They're using English words and phrases, but it's expressing an African culture.
But does the vocabulary tend to be universal throughout?
Yes, you've got a core vocabulary that would be universal. I mean, you've got things like the majority of verbs come, go, take, bring, put. You've got a core vocabulary. You've got body parts. You've got numbers and so on. So you've got a lot of vocabulary that would be shared. Again, in different regions, you might get borrowings from different local languages. But since the pidgin was meant to be the language that allowed communication where previously none was possible, it's terribly important that it doesn't change too much. And what would be the point of having something that was meant to facilitate communication if it was no good to you once you left your own country? So in fact, you find that even words that are used differently from the way they're used in English are often common throughout the area. Shall I give you an example?
Please.
If you take an example like chop, which can mean food or eat, chop fine, you know, like bon appétit. Eat well, chop fine. Or, I know but chop no nothing. I haven't eaten anything. Take this chop, go. Take this food away. So you've got that word chop. And you would find that all the way from Gambia down to, shall we say, Cameroon, with the same meaning. It can function as a noun. It can function as a verb. I mean, people don't go around saying, oh, gosh, I'm going to use it as a verb now. But really, that's what it's doing. You say, chop, I'm fine, you know, eat it. Or it can function as an adjective of sorts in the sense that if I say to you, you chop masa, na die, you eat a great deal, chop masa, chop master. You're really eating well. Then, if you like, you could say that's functioning as an adjective. But it's the same word throughout the area.
Proper.
How you take person?
For land book.
Abi then gear something chop.
Did you man know that for this kind of team? They say the boy gave.
Can I ask you what is the health of pigeons? Are they thriving or?
They are. You see, one of the things that's intriguing is you might think that they would develop closer and closer and closer to English, and sometimes in vocabulary you would think that. But the basic language, which is unbelievably easy to learn. And I mean that. For example, you take the verbs. There's only one form. You know how in English you have I walk, you walk, he was walking, he walked, that sort of thing. And it's even worse if you've got an irregular verb. But in the pigeons, you tend to have one form, waka. And that is for any form. The past is indicated by a little auxiliary. So you'd say, awaka, that's now I walk. If you want to indicate that you're going on, you're walking at this particular time, you'd say adiwaka. If you want to say I walked yesterday, abinwaka yesterday. I will walk agowaka tomorrow. And in that sense, you only have to learn a relatively small vocabulary, and you've got the same little auxiliaries, as it were, that can indicate all sorts of nuances of time and aspect. One of the best ways to illustrate the subtlety and the effectiveness of pidgin is to quote a couple of proverbs for you. Because in these proverbs, you get encapsulated wisdom. I mean, Chinua Achebe once said that they were the palm wine with which words are eaten. And so you get little proverbs like, one hand no fit tie bundle. You cannot tie a parcel with one hand. You need cooperation. Or you get one like, dog ilas na God declinam. And that really means that God wipes the dog's backside. And initially you might think that's a relatively unpleasant one. But what it means is God helps those who cannot help themselves, which from my point of view is infinitely, that's a nicer God than the God who only helps those who help themselves.
My father, before my father getting wife of Boku, you know, get equality palava. He live well for he be a guy for his own house. But that time don't pass before white man come within one wife for one man.
There is a tendency among some people to smile at the quirky ways people from other language groups deal with English syntax or pronunciation. But as Dr. Todd points out, they are simply grafting an internal logic from their own languages onto English.
In our restaurant, we serve basically curry, but tandooris, as people are getting used to it, they're eating more and more. But at the big restaurants or the more popular restaurants, they have started on the menu to explain the dishes, and which is making much easier for the customers.
One of the things that people notice most about a quote-unquote Indian accent is, again, what linguists call retroflexion. In other words, when you're speaking, you turn the tongue round a little bit. And so you would say things like, what do you intend to do today? And turning the tongue round, you immediately just begin to sound that little bit Indian. I'm not trying to be insulting or anything. And that is part of an articulatory setting of the Indian languages. And so when that generation comes over to this country that was brought up speaking an Indian language, they will carry their retroflexion over into English. Yes, not only the retroflexion, but features like saying things like, I'm thinking about him all the time. I am listening. I am seeing him now. That sort of construction that we often think about, because their own languages permit them to use the progressive form with any verb, whereas in English we have limitations on it. But it's the same with another Indianism that we tend to think about is someone will say, I'm going to pictures, and they will not use the definite article. And you say to somebody, well, why don't you use the definite article? And then you think, how on earth? I would say I'm going to hospital, but I'm going to the pictures. English is incredible when you think about its use of definite and indefinite articles. And so either people will generalize and cut it out altogether, or they will follow the influence of their own language, where they may not have a particular article in their own languages. I mean, Irish, for example, doesn't have an indefinite article. It's nothing inferior about a language, it's just a fact.
It is little wonder that people are sometimes tripped up by the intricacies of English. It is a remarkably complex language. Take a simple word like set. It has 58 separate meanings as a noun, 126 as a verb, and 10 as a participial adjective. It takes the Oxford English Dictionary's 60,000 words, the length of a short novel, to define them all. Or consider phrasal verbs, that is, verb phrases that change meaning through the addition of a preposition, as in look up, look at, look over, and look round. Native speakers tend to take these for granted, but for anyone learning English, they can be extremely bewildering. Listen to Dr. John Wright discussing their mysteries with French, German, Spanish, and Korean students in Bristol.
Have a quick look at the phrasal verbs. Have we mentioned all of these or any of these? Like, make up has different meanings. You make yourself up before a party, and I just made up an example. And I'm sorry that I insulted you yesterday. I'll make it up to you.
Yes.
And we're a bit late. We'll have to make up time. Different meanings.
What is ketchup?
Good question.
It's not the...
Who's tomatoes?
No, nothing to do with tomato ketchup. No. Have you heard that, Sandra?
When you
ketchup?
Take a bus, right? When you get on a bus, you can use ketchup.
No, we would say catch, but when you have the particle up, catch up, it creates another meaning, a different meaning, which is one problem. That's catch, but not catch up again. Any more which are new here? How did you find that? Was that easy or difficult?
Difficult.
Right. And what makes phrasal verbs difficult for you?
Because in English, there is lots of exception.
And if I put another preposition after the verb, the meaning change again.
Can you think of an example like that? So if you say look as the basic verb.
Look up, look out, look for.
Look after.
Look after.
The baby.
Yeah, look into a problem. Do you have anything similar in your language?
No.
So it's a special feature of English for you. Okay. Any other problems with phrasal verbs? Do you find it difficult to understand if people use one?
Oh, yes, of course.
Why?
First of all, it's difficult to understand everything that English people say. But phrasal verbs, it's difficult to use, so it's difficult to understand.
Ayako Matsuo teaches Japanese studies at Manchester University. I asked her if it is difficult for the Japanese to learn English.
The answer is mixed. To start with, lots of people would like to speak English because it's not just, English language, but it's world language. So particularly young people, it's also the language for music, arts, all sorts of things. So they would like to learn, but they somehow think, learning English is wonderful but difficult.
When you were learning English, were you struck by any particular difficulties, any quirks of the English language that threw you or amused you? Or
I find English spelling is difficult because it's not like you don't spell like you pronounce.
Yeah.
And I find lots of idioms is difficult. And still I'm struggling with prepositions, which prepositions to use. And passive forms, I find it difficult, and some tense. Yeah, lots of things. The more you know about English, you feel more, it's a difficult language. I feel like it's still a long way to master English.
And what about, was there anything that impressed you about English? That you thought, this is something in this foreign language that actually we don't have in our own, or it works better at doing certain things?
English. I think it's also the variety. Japanese is a bit similar because we borrow lots of words and got into English, but English has a similar history. You learned some Latin words or, Greek words and French words, and these days Japanese words as well. So we think Japanese is quite a flexible language. We can actually import some English words and we put it like tape recorder. So we thought it's flexible, but English probably also, bit of a flexible language, blowing lots of words.
And conversely, have you found any deficiencies in English that you find that it's difficult to express?
Pronunciation is difficult. In Japanese, we don't have any L and R distinction, and my English sometimes causes lots of problems.
No fewer than 20,000 words of English origin are now comfortably ensconced in the Japanese language, though often with modifications that do not always make the source immediately evident. Productivity, for instance, became, and my apologies to any Japanese speakers for my pronunciation, puru daku chibichi. Elevator, meanwhile, became arabeta, beefsteak bifuteki, salad sarada, and cheese chiizu. Altogether, as much as 10% of Japanese vocabulary is thought to be based on Western words, most of them from English. Elsewhere, the march of English into other languages has been scarcely less profound. In Eastern Europe, the fall of communism and the emergence of a free market meant increased exposure to Western goods, but also to the language of capitalism. I asked Peter Kohivchak from the Department of Translation Studies at Warwick University what influences this had had on language in his native Poland.
Well, the English has for a long time been an important language in Poland, but after 1989 it's become even more important, not only in Poland, in other East European countries. People very soon realized that the way of communicating with the outside world and the way success means learning English and being able to communicate in English.
And to what extent has English become the language of commercial discourse?
The pace of change is so fast that the language cannot catch up with it. So very often it's much easier to conduct the conversation in English using English vocabulary. The businessmen or the city people, if you listen to them, you find out that 40% of the vocabulary they are using is English. I've got the magazine here. It's the magazine is the equivalent of the Polish equivalent of, I don't know, of the American Times, but it's for the Poles. And if you look at advertisements, a big part of them is in English. This one says, "Watch the world." And this is the advertisement of for the Swiss Tissot watches. And a lot of these texts are in English. Now, what it signifies means that English is the language of prestige, on one hand, that you are in. But also the people who advertise, they know that this is the language of prestige, and it goes with upward movement, social movement. So people who have English, they've got the access to better life. And it's true, and you've got better prospects. You earn more money. So it's a part of the economic phenomenon. And as you drive around Poland, you'll be surprised how many shops, how many enterprises provide information in English. In the street signs. Mm. It's very little at the moment. There's really little concern of what happens to Polish if you do that. Somehow the Poles haven't got as many anxieties as the French have got. And there is no resistance to it. Then it does happen.
We make it sound as if not only is there no resistance, but it's actually embraced.
Yes, it is embraced, yes. Yes, it is embraced.
Sometimes, however, there is a resistance to the incursions of English, as the writer Marika Kobold discovered when her novel Guppies for Tea was translated from English, in which it was written, into her native Swedish. Even the most common English expressions were ruled inadmissible.
I had this argument with my publishers and the translator, and I said, surely everyone will understand this particular expression. But they said it's not only a matter of that, there's a big debate going on, and reviewers and people, the Guardian of the Swedish language, sort of, they hate it's getting in more and more into Swedish people are more and more using English words and translators are leaving them in. So they are trying to clamp down on that, which is fair enough.
To what extent is that sort of infection from the English-speaking world a genuine concern? I mean, you know how the French are
exactly
often obsessed by Anglicisms creeping into their language, flooding into their language. Is that same thing happening in Sweden? And are people quite concerned about it?
I think it's a concern, but not in any way in the same way as it is in France. I think people are just... It's an intellectual debate now, and people are guarding against it in translation works and when they write themselves. It's even for a Swede writing in Swedish, it seems to be easier sometimes to grab an expression in English. And that is what they're trying to stop happening. They're trying to make people use what we have in Swedish. Because, of course, the more you go to another language, the more you actually lose. You probably, if you'd really worked hard enough, would find a perfectly good expression in Swedish. But it's easier to grab that handy one in English. And, of course, by that, you lose whole expressions in your own language. And they get out of usage, and your language gets even poorer.
Do you do your own translations? Have you done any of your own translations
into
Swedish?
No. I had to step in and do a fairly radical rewrite on the first book that was translated into Swedish because it was a horror.
In what way? What sort of things did it have in it?
It was a bit like what you call instructions to an electrical gadget. It was an approximation of what I had written. And then it was major howlers that would have been funny if it hadn't sort of broken my heart. Like I said, young people were stepping up the housing ladder, which of course, to my mind, means that you are swapping from one, you know, you're buying a more expensive house and then sure. a more expensive house. And that was translated as all over the village, young people were clinging on to ladders outside their houses. And I also had somebody blowing a raspberry, which was translated that the old admiral spat a raspberry across the room.
So the translator didn't actually come to you with any queries?
No, I wish she had. She was new, and I now have a very, very fine translator, and she does a fantastic job. As much as you can when you're translating at all, and translating from a wide language to a narrower language, she's doing a fantastic job. But that first one maybe should not have been translating.
As you will know if you've ever tried to assemble a toy or program a video recorder by following instructions written in Taipei or Canton, English in the wrong hands has a certain capacity for confusion. Here are some suitably inscrutable Oriental instructions for putting together a barbecue set. Place the handle of the blunt side of the cricket chirps and fasten the clinch and put in the complete cricket crips. Attention, please always choose a place with a coal scuttle. Also, in no case the tool should be closed and over-accommodated. Please do not pour gas or gasoline liquid. For setting fur, use setting fur material, such as setting fur paste and setting fur bolt. Well, that seems perfectly clear, doesn't it? There is no doubt that English has become the most global of languages, the lingua franca of international business, science, education, politics, and pop music. About 330 million people in the world speak English as a native language, as compared with 260 million for Spanish, 150 million for Portuguese, and a little over 100 million for French. No other language is spoken as an official tongue in more countries, 44, as against 27 for French and 20 for Spanish. And none is spoken over a wider area of the globe. Two-thirds of scientific papers, 70% of the world's mail, 90% of what is written on the Internet is in English. It is also the de facto language of international aviation.
Hello, Milano. I for you, I'm from London to Fiumicino.
Alitalia 305, buonasera, radar contact, proceed as clear.
Geneva, bonsoir, from Alitalia 305.
Alitalia 305, descend to flight level.
An Italian pilot flying an Italian plane into Italian airspace contacts Italian air traffic control, all speaking in English. But as I learned from retired commercial pilot John Cox, there is no guarantee that English will be the language of international air travel forever.
Well, English is the language used by most international airlines, and it is a requirement that at all international airfields, the controllers there should be able to speak not only their own local language, but also English to communicate with international aircraft. But we're not allowed to say English is the language of aviation, although in effect it really is. And because of the some other countries feel that their language should not be discredited or disregarded. And so in the official documents of the International Civil Aviation Organization, it always uses this terminology. English should be used pending the development and adoption of a more suitable form of expression for universal use. There's no sign of that coming along yet, and I doubt whether it ever will, but that satisfies the sensibilities of some people who speak other languages other than English.
And would it be right in assuming that's French? Speaking people probably.
I didn't want to say that.
But I mean, English, even for those of us who speak it as native tongues, it's a language that has a lot of scope for ambiguity. How do you get around that when you're flying airliners and communicating with...
Well, communicating with the air traffic control, we try to use standard phrases. if you've got to say something out of the usual, that may be a problem, but usually most of the communications are all in standard phraseology. One particular problem we did have, I've been connected with the transport of dangerous goods on aircraft, which can be done safely if it's done properly. And in the description of dangerous goods, we have problem with this word inflammable. And even I have to think sometimes, does inflammable mean it's going to burn or it doesn't burn? And to people whose English is not their native language, it can be very confusing. And they say, well, what does it mean? Is it going to burn or not going to burn? And when you tell them that inflammable means it's going to burn, they find this sort of incredible and incomprehensible that inflammable means the same as flammable. Mm-hmm. So we have tried to standardize on the word flammable, which does away with that ambiguity.
Requiring pilots and air traffic controllers to communicate in a language other than their own would seem to be a recipe for confusion. I asked John Cox whether this was so.
Certainly has been confusion in some cases, and I don't like to talk about individual cases, but obviously there have been confusion in times of the communications between the air traffic control and the pilots, particularly where both the pilots and the air traffic controller are not native English speakers. And then you get a sort of double problem that they don't quite understand each other. We've seen some recent accidents which appear to be due to this, although the final report, for instance, of the recent crash on the approach to Delhi has not been published yet. But it would appear that there, one of the aircraft involved, one was descending, one was climbing out of Delhi, and one misunderstood which height he was cleared to. And so that's why they collided. They both ended up at the same height. And both of the pilots involved were non-native English speakers, and the controller at Delhi would be speaking with an Indian accent anyway, and so one of the pilots had misunderstood which height he'd been cleared to, and that was the reason those two aircraft collided.
So clearly English needs to be handled with care. But whatever its shortcomings and scope for misunderstandings, there's little likelihood of the world's finding, as the phrase has it, a more suitable form of expression for international use. So English is bound to remain the world's preeminent language as we move into the 21st century. The question is, what kind of language will that be? And that is our subject for next week. So far in this series, we've been looking at the growth and development of English. But it's as well to remind ourselves that English is a relative newcomer on these islands, and that there are places where other older languages are still thriving, sometimes against considerable odds. One such language is Gaelic, and one such place to hear it is here on South Uist in the Outer Hebrides. This is where our story began, with the choir of St. Peter's Church singing in the language which we might all now be speaking had history taken any of several very slight turns. English, as we've seen, was shaped by the conquests of various peoples, Angles, Saxons, and Jutes, Vikings, directly from Scandinavia and indirectly from Ireland, and finally Norman French. And then it began a series of conquests of its own, extending outwards into the wider world and pushing native languages like Gaelic and Welsh into the furthest corners of the British Isles. Against such an onslaught, it is a small miracle that a tongue like Gaelic has survived as well as it has. Unlike Welsh, Gaelic has no official status, and its future is by no means assured. I asked Neil McMillan, a crofter on South Uist, how his native tongue is doing.
Well, fortunately, it's still holding its strength. But I can see a decline just the same. There's so much pressure from incomers who don't have the language, and they don't bother to learn the language and to be more or less integrated into the island society.
Now, just from day to day in your normal life, what proportion of the time are you using Gaelic, and what proportion of the time?
Oh, we never speak a word of English among ourselves.
Really?
Never. We speak in Gaelic and we think in Gaelic and we get on with our lives.
And the same when you meet your neighbours and so on.
Of course, yes. It's all Gaelic. We speak among ourselves. It's the Gaelic of the church. It's the Gaelic of the locality, of the Isles.
School teacher Mary McGuinness also lives on South Uist. Like most native islanders, Gaelic is her mother tongue. She and her husband encouraged their three daughters, Jane, Jessica, and Helen, to use it also, but not always without a little gentle resistance.
Is it what you speak at home, Narendra?
It is, normally, yes, all the time. Although the children want to speak a lot more English than we would like them to, and also than we do ourselves. And we have a battle getting them to speak Gaelic, although their Gaelic is reasonably good.
Why is it only reasonably good? If they've had it from birth, why?
Because they seem to have this belief that English is so much more attractive and so much more easy to speak, and the pool of television and magazines, the English world seems to be pulling them towards English, and they're not so good at hanging on to that.
It hasn't then been going on for a long time? I mean, you must have had the pull of television and radio and pop music and everything when you were growing up.
Not to the same extent.
Right. And what sort of proportion of people in a place like South Uist will we find speak Gaelic as a native tongue?
As a native tongue, probably 90% of the people who are living there now.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Will be speaking it as a native tongue.
And what kind of health is it in overall?
Over 10 years ago, there was a program started by the local authority where the children would be taught through the medium of Gaelic, and that has made a big difference to its revival. So we're hoping that its health is going to improve from now on. So the young ones are getting taught to read, write, count, do everything through the language. That's the 5-year-olds upwards. That type of education is only 10 years old, so obviously it's going to have its own problems, but it's certainly a way of addressing the backslide that has been over the last 20 years.
And do you believe that you can save a language?
Well, I think so. We have to think, to be serious about it and realise that it needs us for it to survive, and that every single person has their own bit to do, and if we don't do that, if one parent doesn't pass it on to their child, that's a whole line of people that are not going to have it.
And I suppose an obvious question would be, why does it matter? I mean, why does it matter to you? What is the importance of... You're going to understand each other in English anyway. English is the language of you know, Britain, certainly the modern world generally. Why is it important to you to save a little fringe language like Gaelic?
Because it's the dearest thing we have that our parents gave us, and there is no English in the world that could do for us what our Gaelic songs and our Gaelic heritage, a wealth of sayings, poems, songs, music, that could never be replaced by anything in English that I've ever heard.
Really?
Yes.
You find it much more expressive?
Oh, absolutely. It's just the language of our lives. I mean, it's so much a part of us as breathing is.
When you consider the size and strength of the language Gaelic is up against, it's hard to be too optimistic about its long-term future. Estimates of the number of people who speak English as a first language are usually placed in the range of 330 to 350 million. Not many at all compared with, say, Mandarin Chinese, which is spoken by at least double that number. However, no other language is spoken as an official language in more countries, 44, and none enjoys a wider geographical spread as a native tongue. 1.6 billion people, roughly a third of the world's population, live in countries where English has official status. And of course, it is used as a second language by more people than any other. I asked Loretta Todd of Leeds University, an expert on world Englishes, whether this was a good thing.
It's both a good and a bad thing. It's almost like everything that is good has the potential for bad as well. Now, it's good in the sense that there's communication among people where previously there was no communication. It's good in the sense that we can read in English about the cultures of other people. We can understand them better. So in that sense, the English language is, if you like, the language, the lingua franca of the world. We can all use it and talk with each other. And hopefully, if you talk, you can avoid some of the problems that previously existed. But the negative side of the English language, I sometimes think of it that English is almost like a linguistic virus, in that, wonderful as it is having a very detrimental effect on local languages. I mean, as you can probably hear from my accent, I come from Ireland, and the Gaelic language that existed in Ireland has a literature that is at least as old as the literature in English. It had a grammar book in the 7th century. It has a history that one could weep over, as it were. But the English language has been so successful in Ireland that perhaps fewer than 5% of the country, of the people in the country, use Irish fully and adequately. Now, that's desperately sad. And I go to places like West Africa, and even in 10, 15 years, you can see a difference. That somebody will say, oh, my mother tongue is Lamso, or my mother tongue is Bikom, but I don't use it anymore. And so you're finding that we're losing a lot of the linguistic wealth in the world. And I honestly think it is a little bit like the loss of the forests. We won't fully appreciate how much culture we have lost until perhaps it's too late.
Thanks in large part to its immense geographical spread, English has developed more dialects than any other language group. And particularly in its country of birth, users are passionately defensive about them, as here at the centenary gathering of the Yorkshire Dialect Society.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm getting old anyway, so dialect is not going to die in my time, but I hope it won't die next century either, because in my mind there's no doubt at all, if you want to really stress something, it's far better in dialect.
Well, you see, it saves breath as well, though, because do you know that the word something takes 1.95 seconds to say, and the word summit only takes 0.98 of a second to say? Yeah. So therefore, you see, you save your breath, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. Economical, yes. We don't waste as bad as in North England, do we?
One man who knows more about dialects than almost any other is Stanley Ellis, a retired professor of linguistics at Leeds University. To help me understand just how dialects evolve, he took me to a lonely windswept ridge called Otley Shevin on the edge of the Yorkshire Dales.
Have you got your eyes closed?
Shut tight.
Right, now step forward, and you only need to do perhaps 20 or so steps at most. I'll make absolutely sure that you don't trip over any stones. And as we reach forward, say another, only another 5 or 6 yards. Are you confident?
And no, I have no confidence at all.
No confidence. There is a stone in front of you, but it won't hurt you. Now, if you just stand there quietly and open your eyes.
Wow. That's incredible, isn't it?
Isn't it wonderful? Yeah. Now, where we are, looking right down over Wharfdale, there is still on the ridge ahead of us, roughly, a boundary between what I would call the North Midland group of dialects and the Northern group of dialects. And it's tremendously important. There's a valley running up there called the Washburn Valley, which comes down into Otley, and the farmers from there would all talk North Midland. You go to the very top of the valley, and you go over a few fields, and the farmers in the farms over those fields talk completely differently, because they go down to a place called Pateley Bridge, where there is their market. Market, whereas in the valley, the Washburn Valley, they come down to Otley. And north of this division, they would say Doon and Round and a boat, and there's gone in a boat there. Whereas south of it, in Otley, where we are looking, they would say Down and Round and a Bart, and I'm going down there. And the complete contrast owes its difference to a historical division that goes back to what I will call Anglo-Saxon times, but there were Anglian tribes rather than the Saxons who were King Alfred's lot down in Wessex in the south of England. There were the Mercians who were south of Elmet, and the Northumbrians, effectively north of the Humber, who were north of Elmet. So it's an absolutely wonderful place to stand, and you're seeing history, you're seeing language division, and you're seeing beautiful scenery as well.
It's fabulous. It is just incredibly glorious.
People get emotive about language. They think it belongs inside them. I always remember talking to people about their words, and they say, but so-and-so is real Yorkshire. And what they mean is our kind of Yorkshire, which may be East Yorkshire or North Yorkshire, which is quite different from the West Yorkshire. I had a colleague at the university who used to say, I used to travel home by bus every night up into the Heavy Woolen district, which is Dewsbury, Batley, and it's to the south of Leeds. And he said that he would stand in the queue for the bus and try and identify where people would get off the bus on the way home. And he said, if they got off at the wrong spot, I knew they'd flitted. He meant, I knew they'd moved house, because their speech told where they will be born in the communities on the way to his home.
But what is the future of dialects in Britain? Stanley Ellis takes a positive view.
Folks say to me now, populations are on the move, people are changing their living. You look at the ordinary people, the not very influential people, the non-Times readers, and there are mountains of folk who still live near their granny, and their mother-in-law looks after the children while they go out to work, and there's the close extended family. And these villages, and even the towns of West Yorkshire, and the Midlands, and all over the country, you've still got people who are living in tight communities, which promote, to my mind, the tight community speech. That's where your dialects come from. That there aren't a lot of outsiders forcing their way in, and people are not moving away. The only trouble is that under the pressures of modern times, which are entirely new, these dialects, I suppose, are under threat. But what I find is that they're not completely under threat for destruction in England. They're changing. Children today will talk identifiably locally, especially in pronunciation, especially in vowel and consonant sounds. But they don't talk like their grandparents. But they're still identifiably of that particular town or that part of a town. Bristol rather than Bath or whatever. And that will develop among the young.
So where now for English? We've seen in these programs how English has been mauled and molded by huge upheavals in its structure. But even now, changes are going on all the time. Changes in the way we speak and spell. 100 years ago, gold was still often pronounced gould. The first edition of the Oxford English Dictionary listed maybe as an archaic expression. 50 years ago, the Daily Mail ran an article on American expressions that it described as positively incomprehensible to the average Briton. Among the terms it listed were commuter, intern, seafood, and living room. 15 years ago, no one had heard of cyberspace or the Internet or Walkmans or cafe latte or any of several thousand other terms that have poured into English and continue to pour in yet. As David Dennison of Manchester University notes, even punctuation is subject to the relentless whim of progress. The apostrophe, for example, appears to be under threat.
As knowledge of the apostrophe, its correct use in writing, disappears from Britain, I don't know if it's the same in America, people are conscious that perhaps they're doing it wrong, perhaps it might be better to use an apostrophe, and it gets thrown in the so-called greengrocer's apostrophe in all sorts of contexts where you don't expect it. You know, apples 50p a pound with an apostrophe before the S. Or I've even seen a respectable publisher offering their linguistics leaflet, and linguistics had apostrophe S.
Oh, really?
Yep. And that seems to me a death row phenomenon. The apostrophe is more or less useless. It's a very recent invention anyway. It's only about a couple of hundred years old in regular use. It's clearly dying out again. It's conceivable that subtle spell checkers in modern word processors will allow it to survive rather longer than it otherwise would have. But if it weren't for that, I'd say it would probably disappear entirely in a few decades. But in those decades of its dying, it's being used where it shouldn't be, and it's not being used where it should.
John Honey, who has written extensively on the need for standards in English usage, believes the innate richness of the language is being eroded.
Militate and mitigate should be distinguished. Flaunt and flout should be distinguished. Imply and infer should be distinguished. And refute and rebut should be distinguished. Because they have importantly distinguishable meanings. Decimate has come to mean destroy. It used to mean to cull a proportion of. And I am saying that it is the function of schools, it is the function of editors to try and keep these senses apart, to discourage ignorant uses which serve to degrade the language.
But how will English sound in the future? I talked to Derek Britton of Edinburgh University.
Is it possible at all to make any kind of forecasts for where standard English is going in terms of pronunciation?
No.
Fair enough.
Cannot predict linguistic change. There are numerous possibilities, and it won't necessarily take the same route as it has before.
Now, is it possible at all to guess how long we would have to leap forward into the future before English, spoken English, would begin to sound strange to late 20th century ears?
Well, it may be if we don't, as I'm sure we won't, change our spelling system. I don't think, at my guess, you'd find it in hundreds of years possibly all that radically different. I say that because from about the sort of 18th century onwards, when writers begin to insist, well, they insisted earlier, but when it becomes to have weight, especially with the aspiring middle classes, that words are best pronounced, these are Dr. Johnson's words, Dr. Johnson, that words are best pronounced as they are spelt, then standard English spelling is actually a very formidable obstacle with that dictum then of language conforming to spelling. That's a very formidable obstacle to further change, I would have thought.
Richard Hogg of Manchester University voices a similar measure of caution in trying to predict the future of something as fickle as English.
I think overall it's probably very difficult to do so, but you can probably guess at one or two things that will happen in detail. For example, there are still a great many people who dislike the use of pronouns such as him and me being used as a subject of a sentence.
As in it's me.
As in it's me. Or John and him are going to the pictures. And what's interesting is that usage started off probably in the late 18th century and only became widespread at the beginning of the 20th century and is continuing. It seems to be on the increase all the time, so that you can see it just becoming more and more dominant. The great difficulty, however, is in looking at these kind of changes, is that we're now dealing with a population that is overwhelmingly literate and relies on written English to determine what the standard is when you're speaking, even. And that's a phenomenon that didn't exist 250 years ago. That's a new phenomenon with the rise of literacy. And what we can be fairly certain about is written language is very, very conservative compared with spoken language. And the reliance on the written language may inhibit change. So things may not move as quickly as they have done in the past.
John Honey, as we have heard, has expressed concerns about the loss of distinction in certain words. I asked him if he thought the language was in terminal decline.
One of the things that you will hear from linguists and from lay people all the time, language is in constant flux. It is stupid to try and put up barricades against particular usages which you think are to the degradation of the language. Language is in constant flux. Answer, not true. The English language is changing all the time in tiny ways. As a proportion of the total language, these small points about which the language gurus want people to be alerted and to be watchful, that the total number of those is very small as a proportion of the whole language. One of the glories of the English language is its stability over time. We can now read things that were written 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago. We can attempt to read the language of Shakespeare, maybe with some help, of Jane Austen, maybe with some help, more help than is available to students studying A-level Jane Austen. But the fact is, stability is greater than flux. Stability is greater than change in the English language.
Many people in Britain and elsewhere fear that the irresistible weight of American culture will lead to what is sometimes called the coca-colonization of the world, leading, in effect, to an American takeover of English. I discussed this with David Dennison.
Should British speakers of English or speakers of non-American varieties of English be concerned about this? Should they see this as a threat?
I don't think so. I mean, power follows money. America is the powerful nation, and foreigners who want to learn English will increasingly want to follow the American pattern for learning English, and it's entirely reasonable that they should do so. I don't think it's a real danger. The contrary tendency to want to mark out your own language as individual and shared by a relatively small group is always there. It's always persistent, so there will always be differences. I don't think we're ever going to get a homogeneous dialect right across the English-speaking world. So to that extent, I'm not worried by the dominance of American language. The dominance of American culture is another thing, and we could argue about that.
Speaking personally, I would hate to see the day when all of us in the English-speaking world spoke with a uniform vocabulary and a universal accent. I asked Loretto Todd whether she thought this was remotely likely.
I don't think that's possible. I really and truly don't think that's possible. You only have to move around from one tiny little area of England to the next to realize that although we've been exposed to the same media influences, certainly as far as radio is concerned, the influence has been there for 60, 70 years. Television has been there for, 40, 50 years. And people are hearing these features, and yet local pronunciations can remain, local form, idioms and so on can remain. There may be one that would be the written standard international medium that we would all use. But I cannot see monolectal monotony, as it were. I see variation, vitality. And one of the things I also believe is that even if we became monolectal, as it were, you'd get poets and playwrights and novelists taking the language and stretching it and modifying it, and new things would come in.
This parrot is no more. It's ceased to be. It has expired.
I discovered that to most of them, Pershaw was little more than a vague romantic name.
And the slithy toves did gyre and gimble.
Against the say of troubles, and by opposing...
Murder noses on red rum. Mum, it poses optimum.
Question time, these two pansies over there.
The growth of post-neoclassical endogenous growth theory and the symbiotic relation...
Can I do you now, sir?
Perhaps no other language on earth is more gloriously illogical, more dazzlingly inconsistent, more bewilderingly idiosyncratic than English. but it is also a language of great beauty and potency, a language equally at home whether dealing with the rich lyricism of a sonnet or the technological complexities of interstellar spaceflight. English will continue to evolve in ways we can't begin to guess at, and people will continue to argue over the best ways to use it. But as far as I'm concerned, until something better comes along, it'll do for me.
Journeys in English was written and presented by Bill Bryson, produced by Brian King, and first broadcast as Mother Tongue on BBC Radio 4 from the 13th of December 1997 until the 17th of January 1998.